Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the TetraCast. I am Brian Vitale. Joining me, we have Josh Torres.
Salutations.
Mikhail Matnani.
Hello.
Adam Vitale.
Welcome back, Brian.
And Chowman Wu.
How's it going?
Yep, so I'm back after some just, you know, IRL trips the last 2 weekends. So thank you, everyone, for holding down the fort throughout the back part of March. No James this morning. He has an IRL birthday something with a friend over where he's at. So we'll catch up with him next week. So it's the five of us holding on the fort for the first podcast of April. And yeah, so I was kind of catching up on everything you guys talked about the last couple weeks. It looks like the big headline was Crimson Desert, which has kind of been talked about across, you know, different social media and forums and Reddit, like in a lot of different lights. So it's been really interesting to see kind of all the different ways that that game has been responded to, reacted to, kind of from, you know, hardcore press and casual, you know, just kind of like, you know, friends that aren't in the space have, you know, heard about it, like on my Facebook and things like that. So it's kind of been an interesting game to follow, not one that I've touched into myself, but I kind of checked in on all of that over the back part of March. So what I did is last 2 weekends, I went to spring training over in Arizona 2 weekends ago, just to see some of the, you know, the later last spring game and training games before the baseball season kicked off. And then last weekend went to a concert up in Denver. So for just a small folklore is not the word for it, like kind of a folksy pops singer. It's like a small venue, but it was really fun and enjoyable. Went with my girlfriend and some friends that live in the area. So that was my last 2 weeks. While I was out, I had my Switch 2 and I played games like Pokemon ZA. I was kind of finishing all the DLC on that. Like I was just talking about before we press record on the podcast, how I didn't realize that when you play the Mega Dimension DLC, there's like a credits, and then there's like a post game, and then there's like a post game in terms of like having to keep revisiting riffs and, you know, kind of grinding out a lot of things that weren't actually that fun, but I felt like I needed to do it because I had my Switch 2 on me and that's what I was playing at the time. So that was my last 2 weeks. It was basically doing all the things you could do in Pokemon CA. So I finished like the Mega Pokedex and the regular Pokedex. I don't quite have the full Mega Dimension Pokedex done, but I'm at the point where I'm like, I'm done. I've seen enough. I probably have like 80 hours in that game now, but that's what I've been doing. So that's where I'm coming from. So yeah, I was looking at the kind of the lineup for this week. A few games that, you know, have been released that we were talking about, but just not that we have touched into or able to talk to on this podcast. So we're going to kind of just kind of wing this opening section a little bit where we talk about what games we've been playing. Josh has kind of kept something close to his chest that he's listed here as Brain Rot that he wanted to talk about. So we'll touch in on that. Adam has actually been playing a game that I don't know if we've really touched into on the podcast earlier. And maybe we'll just kind of start out with that. And Adam, I know you'll also be talking a little bit in terms of you finally put up some final kind of write-ups for your time at GDC a few weeks back. So I know you'll have a little bit of time to speak to that as well. So without further ado, I might just kind of hand it off to you, Adam, to talk about you've been playing the Tales of Zhilla remaster, which came out in January, correct me if I'm wrong?
Last October.
October. Why did I think January?
Because Tales of Graces came out a January ago, 2025.
That's probably it. Okay.
Yeah.
So it came out even a while ago than I remembered. But you finally were able to put some time into it between all the other releases. And, you know, it's not a new release. It's a remaster. So just a kind of a little window here to talk about, you know, you've played the game before. I know other people have played the original, you know, PS3 version of the game. So what it's like to revisit that game, what you feel about the remaster, and just kind of, you know, impressions from that point of view.
Yeah. So, this came out in late October. I think around that time I was in the middle of writing up or like consolidating those Dragon Quest walkthroughs that I'd worked on. So I couldn't get to it at the time. And then like Octopath Traveler was around there also, Zero. And now that some of like the big February and March releases, you know, a lot of those have come and I've played through several of those, you know, like, all right, trying to revisit a few games that I couldn't get to back last year. So playing this one, Tales of Zhilla. So I guess I should say that I have played every English Tales game, so quite a lot of them. There's a few Japanese-only ones I haven't played yet. Tales of Zhilla is one of those games that I never really attached to it. And in fact, It's one of those games that, like, thinking back on it, it was actually kind of, I should say, literally forgettable. I'm like, what even happened in that game? I don't remember. Like, I played it, got all the achievements and everything, and I don't remember, like, what it even is. Like, it left that much of an impression on me, I guess. So I always kind of felt it was very average. Like, I didn't love it. I didn't hate it. It was just kind of fine. So, like, all right, let me replay the remaster, you know. It's a good refresher on, like, what actually happened in the game. And also, these Tails remasters have, like, the grade shop opened at the beginning. So you can kind of cheat, play through it, you know, with all your bonuses and boosters and whatnot from the get-go. And, you know, why not do it for just a replay? And I guess my feelings of the games haven't really changed a whole lot. But it definitely, I remember some of the parts of the game that I think are kind of, like, poorly done or not very good. Like, for example, there are, in this game, like, in between, like, the cities that you are visiting throughout these games, you know, pretty traditional JRPG style, you go to these, like, field areas, and they're always called, like, something trail or something path or whatever, and they're, like, all exactly the same. They're with, like, different color palettes, like, copy-paste between the different cities, and they're not interesting to go through. They're not fun to explore. They're just kind of like battle corridors, and it's like, oh yeah, I remember these copy-paste field areas. And it's just one of those things that I guess maybe it was for development at the time, just like they just didn't have a lot of budget or resources to make, like, a world. And so you have, like, these canyon path field areas that are all the same. Combat in the game is kind of the it's more in that HPTP style, that, like, what used to be called, like, the Team Symphonia style. Although there are some components of, like, the more graces, like combo counter things, but they're very light compared to the Team Symphonia, just like TP types of combo chains that you can do. And I think a lot of people agree that when it comes to pure gameplay in this era of Tails games, it's the CC style that I think is the really the
Tails of Graces style.
Yeah. Oh yeah. So CC is like combo counter or combo chain or chain counter or something.
It started in the Tales of Destiny remake.
Yeah. Yeah. But... yeah. So I feel like this is common knowledge, but probably less so now. But it's oftentimes referred to as like Team Destiny or Team Symphonia, where you had like these two different, you know, development houses back in like the 2000s and aughts, the aughts and the 2010s, making these games. And it was the Destiny team that made like the Graces version. Graces is on the top of my head because I played that like a year ago. The remaster, which I think is a better game, especially now playing both of these in back-to-back years. Like, yeah, I think Graces is clearly a better game, personally. But yeah, this Tales of Xillia is more the style where it's like you have a TP counter, you can do like attack, 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 basic art, arcane art. There's a few tweaks here and there, but it's not as crazy in terms of like some of the combo chaining and flashiness that you can get in some of those CC games, the Tales of Destiny games. So, like, again, it's totally fine. The combat is fine. It's just not, like, if you compare it to, like, the rest of the games in the series, it falls somewhere in the middle for me.
I think I was extremely hyped for the game when it first announced on back in the PS3 in Japan, because they're like, we got both teams. We got the best of the Symphonia team, and we got the best of the Destiny team. So I was, like, you know, super hyped about it. Then when you play it, it's like, I don't think this is that good.
Yeah, I remember, like, Xillia, in my memory, like, it was an interesting game because it was natively built for the PS3, like, because, you know, Graces beforehand was for the Wii.
Yeah,
initially. And so I was excited because I was like, oh, they're gonna, like, yeah, I'm really interested to see, like, what a native PS3 natively built Tails game would be like. And it's an okay game. It's a solid game, from my memory of it. I think Xillia 2 is a more interesting game when it comes to gameplay. Maybe at the cost of, like, a somewhat compromised structure.
Yeah.
Because Xillia 2 is a way different structure than Xillia 1 in terms of
how you progress
through the game. Yeah. But yeah, Xillia 1 is, like, it's a very... If nothing else, I think it's one of those games that really stuck out in terms of, like, the cel-shaded visual style and, like, almost a like a vibrant watercolor-esque like aesthetic to it that you didn't really see much in Tales up to that point, because they were so restricted by technology, very polygonal, still look great, but like especially the pixel art Tales games. But like Xillia was like an interesting mixed bag of like it has not maybe as interesting as gameplay as like, you know, Graces before it, but it does have an interesting style to it, and especially like, you know, having this dual opening theme concept animated by UFO Table, which we'll get into later, because of having dual protagonists between Jude and Mila.
Yeah, so actually I was actually about to mention like playing this game and like the opening scene and like the animated cutscenes in this game, it's kind of shocking. Like, these are way better than what they had in like Tales of Arise, which I know was also the same studio. And I remember when they had announced that way back when, like, yep, we're still doing the animated cutscenes, people were like, yes. And the reason why people were excited for that is because they saw the cutscenes that were in like Tales of Xillia or Tales of Berseria or Zeteria or whatever. Like, some of that stuff is really good. And then like the Arise animated cutscenes, I just remember were like, not great.
Stiff.
Yeah, very.
Yeah, they weren't their best work.
Yeah, and they had like a lot of the, I don't necessarily blame them for this, but like they had more of the CG animation, but it wasn't very good CG animation. And so like playing through this game, not just the opening, but just some like the animated cutscenes. Like, for example, there's a scene when you have like the armies of the two cities fighting each other, and like, so there's a lot of like just kind of soldiers fighting, you know, in a battlefield. And, you know, something that's relatively hard to animate, like, this looks pretty good. And all the art is very great, and art and animation. So, like, it kind of play. It's in stark contrast, I think, to Arise, where they're just kind of fine. Characters, I've always actually found myself, like, I don't think Jude is a great protagonist, but weirdly enough, I kind of feel like I identify with him, because he's, like, I think he has, like, a similar, like, disposition to me. Which is like kind of curious, kind of obsessive, but also a bit boring. So identify with that.
Because you're saying you wouldn't make a good game protagonist.
Correct. I mean, I don't think he's like an excellent character, but you know, he's just like, hey, I kind of, you know, I don't mind this character, and I feel like that I see some similarities between me and him.
Yeah, I think the concept of him is more interesting than execution, because I do like the concept behind, like, he is like a doctor in training, and the journey to become to get to that profession is more interesting than like the core motivation of his journey. I like that. I like that character arc of him, but not necessarily like what they try to paint him as. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
And then they all got career changes in the sequel, from what I remember.
I think the best character in the game is like easily Rowan, personally.
He's good. Yeah, yeah.
Rowan is basically like the, you know, 60-year-old or maybe older, like former tactician of the army. And kind of like, he's kind of like the guiding hand throughout the group. And he also just kind of like chimes in at the right moment when like when he sees something is like not working out. And he kind of just like he kind of like leads the group from the rear, which is, I guess, what a tactician would do. Not very forcefully, but just kind of because he's so like gentle and caring and like knowledgeable. And he has his own like struggles that he deals with, like with his regrets at his age and things like that. And I'm like, this is actually pretty well done. I actually kind of like it. I like his English voice actor too. Worst character in the game is unfortunately Leia, I think. They kind of do some nice things with her, and she's not as bad as I thought, but it kind of eventually boils down to, and especially in the sequel, like, I do everything that Jude does because I just want to be with Jude, and that's all I think about at all times. It's like, oh, okay.
The tale definitely has like a sort of like a childhood friend problem, because like I think of like Sherryo as well.
Yeah,
I think of Leia.
There's actually, though, there is one scene in this game that I had kind of forgotten about that was like, okay, Leia's maybe not as bad as I had like remembered, but still it kind of not great. So, like, there's a scene near the, like, in the final act of the game where there's actually a pretty long series of events that Jude is basically being, like, all, like, mopey and depressed. And he's just kind of like, what's the point? What am I doing? This is useless. Whatever. I don't care. I'm going to knock the food out of your hand. And then Leia's, like, basically, like, I'm surprised she didn't slap him, but she's, like, doing everything she can to basically try to get him out of that. And I was kind of, like, with her in that moment. Like, I'm like, geez, Jude, stop being a mopey dork. And Leia was like kind of the character that did bring him out of that moment. And like, you know what? I actually kind of like that angle of it, but still. But yeah, it's one of those games that replaying it, I never, like I said, I never really latched onto this game. When I remember when before Graces was announced, I was actually thinking, you know, I bet they're going to remaster Tales of Xillia. And then when they remastered Graces, I was actually thinking at the time, like, oh, they picked the better option. Like, this is the better game to remaster. And now playing through both of these in relative succession, you know, back-to-back years. I'm like, yeah, I prefer Graces. Not even just for its gameplay. I think actually playing through both of their stories, I think they're kind of even, to be honest. I don't know if that's a hot take or not. But
I think that would have been blasphemy like 13 years ago. But
yeah, I think that's considered blasphemy nowadays.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think either are great in the story. But like, for example, I actually kind of realized also like some of the betrayal stuff that Alvin does in this game is kind of like doesn't amount to anything. Like,
I think they're just following a trope, because every Tales game has a trope of someone backstabbing them.
I think some of the plotting is actually like pretty bad. Like, for example, there's a scene in the game that's supposed to be like one of Alvin's biggest betrayals. So this is not a spoiler. I mean, it's very lightly a spoiler. Is Alvin betrays you like 4 times in this game. That's what he does. And there's like this one time where you're like meeting Gaius, who is the villain, the antagonist of the game. And he like betrays you because he's like, I know where the key to the Lance of Kresnik is. It's in the village of Neokara. And then everyone else is like, what the hell, Alvin? What are you doing? Why are you revealing that information? Blah, blah, blah. And you're like, as in that moment, you're like, how dare this dickhead do this? And then like later in the game, like when the battle starts, one of the characters, you may remember Ivar from that town. He's basically Mila's handmaiden and he obsesses over her. He just kind of shows up on the battlefield randomly, like quite literally out of nowhere with the key. And he's like, I have the key and I'm going to activate the lance. So when I'm thinking of just like pure plot movement, it's like, okay, Alvin's betrayal did nothing. It had no point. If it never happened, everything else would have proceeded in the exact same way. Like, it was a totally useless scene that did nothing other than Alvin betrayed you just because he could. Like, it didn't lead to anything. It didn't cause any more conflict than was already there or would happen later. So it's like, that was kind of pointless just to do it because you could. So stuff like that. Like I said, I actually remember really liking Rowan as a character when I first played it and, you know, playing it again. I'm like, you know what? I kind of like this character. I kind of like the archetype. It's a little bit more unique, perhaps, to have that kind of character. Yeah, and also, the other thing to mention is the port, the PC port that I'm playing is just not as good as the Graces one. It's not bad. Like, it's not awful. You know, it's a PS3 game on PC, so it, you know, it's going to run pretty well, I think, regardless. But I'm seeing, like, a lot more visual issues than I did in Graces. Like, for example, there's a pretty persistent, like, screen tearing issue that I'm seeing. And there is no, like, V-Sync option in the game. You can, like, force it to try to help, but it's, like I don't remember having this problem with Graces, and I think Graces just performed better and had better load times and all that throughout than Xillia did. And also, I remember this being an issue when it was first kind of released. So there's some, like, weird, I don't know if it's a frame rate issue or some, like, weird behavior with how the skits work, or that, like, they pop up late. Where it's like, wait, the skit popped up, but it was for like 2 areas ago. So it seems that's like they're true. Not timed very well. Mikhail, I think you checked this out.
Yeah, so a lot of what you're mentioning has been there since launch or like pre-release when I played the Steam version. Like the V-Sync here, I had screen tearing when I was playing on Windows, whatever I did. Even like I remember even checking 480p. to 4K, and it was just like it wasn't giving me a good experience at all when I was using Windows. Steam Deck didn't have the tearing, but it was not great on Windows, and the delayed skit thing was a known bug. Like, everyone complained about it then, and you played it right now and it's still there. That's pretty insane. But there's one thing I'll say, that at least so the Switch version was even worse. It had this T-posing characters moving and stuff like that. I assume you didn't run into that.
No, I have not run into that.
Yeah.
That seems awesome. So, what are you talking about? That seems to enhance the gameplay experience.
Yeah, so I definitely like agree with you that Graces F felt more polished, and like I agree with you, the game is also, I liked it more. It just feels like I bring this up quite a few times on the podcast, how you described Grace's F, where everything was just snappy and responsive. Even though Zillia runs pretty well, it did not feel as snappy as and responsive as Grace's F. That just felt like I was like in butter the whole time. It felt good. This did not feel good.
And also, Zillia was also an unfortunate like game that was used as the reaction to like how Grace's F was in terms of its combat system. Like when you think about like the boss battles in Grace's F versus Zillia, you can tell that like they definitely there was unintentional design behaviors that people exploited in Grace's F that they tried to overcorrect in Zillia, where like the combo limit on bosses felt way more restrictive and stiff in Zillia compared to Grace's F. So like bosses in general, there was less freeform gameplay flow because of that, because of arbitrary restrictions that you can do.
So it seems like the Tales studio had like for a couple of games in a row, they kind of had a concept that they tried to stick to because they really liked it, and that's the linking concept. So
yeah.
It was, I think, first introduced in Zillia, and then Zestiria also had a version of it. So like you link to another character, and that like boosts like your stats between the two characters, depending on like you know what type of character they are, as well as like the linked character has like their own behavior or what they do. Like for example, if you're linked with Mila, she does like a binding technique. If you're linked with Alvin, he does like a breaking guard technique. If you're linked with Leia, she steals stuff and things like that. And then like how the combo chain actually works, like functionally in Zillia, like when you're fighting a boss and you go into Overlimit, and how that works is that you do an art ability, and then you can do like a chained art with your linked partner, which is like a dual art. And then you can kind of link them if you like, this is like top tier high level gameplay. Like this is the ceiling. You can do like a chain of linked arts together. And how that functionally works is like, depending on like the controller configuration for it, like the art button on my controller is A. So like you press like A and then like you do a linked art, and then you do left and A and then up and A, and then like maybe just right stick, left, up, down. And you kind of just do like a chain of arts, but it's like all you have to functionally do is just remember the order. And it's kind of like you just do like five arts in a row, but you're not really like positioning doesn't matter. You don't have a whole lot of control over that. And it basically is just so what it is you go into Overlimit, and then you kind of just do like your sequence that you've set up, like A, left, up, down, right, or whatever. And then you do like five arts in a row, and then like that's it. So like that's about as good as you can make a combo in this game versus, you know, Grace's, where you can basically have like infinite combo if you know what you're doing, which is, you know, does it break the game? Maybe, but it's fun to figure out how to do that, where Zillia is just kind of like, we're not even going to let you do it. So you kind of have to work within the confines of the game, which is, I guess, fine. It's just not as fun. And especially when like this linking combo thing that I mentioned earlier is like, once you find like your sequence, you just do the same thing every time. So it's just kind of boring once you figure it out. So yeah, it is what it is. I know with Zillia 2, one of the big wrenches or wrinkles, I should say, it throws into that is, especially for Ludger, is his weapon switching. So that's like, you know, allows you to get, you know, more creative with how you do your combos and things like that. It's kind of funny. I remember Zillia 2 has like other characters you can play as, but like, why would you?
Like most of the people who played Zillia 2, it's like, yeah, you can't play other characters, but why would you ever play anyone else but Ludger? Because he's like the fucking guy. He is that man. You know, he can do everything and it's fucking fun. And we've definitely talked about it on this podcast too, but like in terms of like co-op friendliness, probably Zillia 2 is one of the ones that's like the most co-op unfriendly when you're playing with another friend, because like if you're playing with someone and they're just playing Ludger, you're kind of just, you know, you're on the sidelines going two thumbs up, you're the guy, you know, you're barely doing anything.
Yeah, now to be clear, I don't hate Zillia. I just, you know, playing through it again, I kind of just like, so sometimes when I replay a game, like I kind of realize, oh, I actually, you know, enjoy this more than my memories, like, thought. Like, for example, I think I played a couple years ago Wild Arms 2 for a second time, and I remember hating it, and I'm like, nah, it's I don't love it, but it's not as bad as I thought. But this game is actually, like, if anything, maybe like around the same or even maybe a little bit less. Like, nah, gave it a second chance. I kind of coming away from it more or less the same way that I did before. So it is what it is.
It is still nice that it's available like on modern platforms and not just, you know, do you have your, pull out your PS3 that you still have, you know.
This is actually one reason why I think having the Tales of Berseria remaster after this feels like such a missed opportunity or just almost a waste, because it's like I totally appreciate a company taking their back catalog and making it more accessible. Whether it's, you know, like, okay, now a couple years ago, Tales of Graces and Tales of Zillia were stuck on the PS3 or the Wii. And that's the only place you could play them. And now you can play them in many places. And like the Steam version, hopefully doesn't like go anywhere for years or decades, right? And then like Tales of Berseria is just kind of like, oh, this is already pretty widely available. Yes, I know it's like improved and now on like the PS5, but like, it, you know, would have been more interesting if it was one of the PS2 games or one of the even more like the dream would be for them to like remaster and newly localize a game that was never localized before. Go for it, Mikhail.
I agree with you about this, even as someone who like Berseria is like I consider it my first or second favorite Tales game, but I feel like even to bring it back and to do like a QOL pass on it or whatever, they've fumbled that as well, because on PC they didn't offer any upgrade path or anything. When they did that, even for Dark Souls, when they did Dark Souls to Dark Souls Remastered, they gave you 50% off. I think Dark Souls the original is crap on PC. I like Durante saved it and all. I just do not care about that. So like remaster for $20 was a good deal. With Berseria, the only thing you're actually getting is you get the DLC included and you get 120 FPS support, but the port is more demanding, supposedly. Like a friend of mine who plays on a gaming laptop said the remaster runs worse than the original, so he just refunded it. So they fumbled that bit up. The PS5 version is good, but the main thing over there is just that you can take screenshots. They didn't block that anymore like they did on the PS4 version.
Oh, I forgot about that.
But they didn't do more than that. Yeah, they didn't do more than that. They didn't do like 120 FPS support, and it surely could have run there. And then having it on Xbox is good because that audience never got it. But I feel like the biggest mess up over here is they did a Switch 1 version. So you have like the worst version of the game now over there. And if you play it on Switch 2, you're still getting 30 FPS with input lag, really bad like draw distance, like Dragon's Dogma on Switch 2. And like the...
Wait. Sorry. This is Switch 2 version or Switch 1 version?
No. There's no Switch 2 version. It's a Switch 1 game, which they released like last month or whatever. So I'm saying that they should have done a Switch 2 version, so at least that audience would have had like a good version of the game. Now they just have the worst way to play Tales of Berseria. And when I did my like tech article on it, like some people were discussing it and said, oh, you should praise it because it's better than the PS3 version. I don't care about the PS3 version, which released in Japan. why do I care about that?
That's crazy.
Like, I compare it to what people played outside Japan and what's available now. So it's just like, I don't get the whole point of that. Like, I enjoyed replaying Berseria, but like, you messed up the new platform launches and you didn't give a loyalty discount on Steam. Like, if they did a loyalty discount on Steam, they would have easily like had more people willing to give it a chance. You know, like, it would have been cheaper to buy the remaster than get all the DLC for the original, but they just messed it up. And you know, like how you brought up how sometimes games don't get marketing, even though they do get marketing. I feel like Berseria had nothing, except they uploaded a shitload of trailers on their YouTube channel last week for all the voice actors. And I'm like, why didn't you do this leading up to the game's launch?
Wait, they actually did, was it English or Japanese voice actors?
It was Japanese, like the character voices for each character. Okay. But they uploaded like 15 of them in a day or something. And I'm like, why didn't you just do this leading up to the remaster? So, yeah, like I just a confusing thing like that. This on top of it being the game which needed the remaster or re-release the least, I'd say. Like, you're not doing Abyss. Like, I want to play Abyss again. I don't want to play it on 3DS.
It's worth mentioning that the 120 FPS thing was done in an update post-launch. Like, I think
it just released in March. Correct.
Yeah.
And yeah, then, it was an update when I posted about it. It wasn't there at launch. So at launch, essentially, you were gaining nothing except just having the DLC and a quote-unquote more demanding version of the same game.
Yeah, and I don't know if there's like any more recent or new patches for like the other platforms, which, you know, maybe fix them.
The Switch patches have always been late for these Tails remasters, but over there, they're like doing more fixes to bugs. But as such, they haven't really done anything on the other platforms. So nothing of note, at least.
And I would probably bet that somewhere around September, October this year, we're going to get Zillia 2 as a remaster. They've already pretty much said that's happening. So it was actually kind of surprising that Berseria kind of snuck in, which I think is, you know, fair. Like, that's the only PS3 game that hasn't been ported at this point. So look forward to that. You can play as Ludger and kick everything's butt.
So fun.
And while we're talking about it, just a related thing. Back in February, we got a teaser between, you know, Tails Studio, Namco Bandai, and is it Ufotable or UFO Table?
We ask this question every time, and I just go with UFO Table, but people are free to pronounce it however they way they want.
Yeah, no, I actually deliberately did not ask the last time because I swore it was Ufotable, but that animation studio that does Tails and Demon Slayer and new Genshin Impact thing or whatever, they had a tease that was, you know, an announcement on April 3rd for the Tails 30th anniversary. And I'm always of the mindset that, like, I sometimes think that some people assume that every, you know, 5th or 10th anniversary has to be like a huge thing, like a new giant project. And like, no, sometimes you can just celebrate anniversaries. It is possible just to say, like, you know, we're proud of the work we've done. But this was something that they announced, like, you know, 2 months in advance or a month and a half in advance for a pretty big anniversary. And, you know, when they announced it that far in advance, like, maybe this is, you know, what could they be cooking for the 30th anniversary? And we got that answer, of course, you know, on April 3rd. And what it is that they are going to, Ufotable and Production IG are preparing a new concert and anime illustrations celebrating the series, 188 just animations from across the different entries of the, you know, the whole Tales series, as well as, I'm trying to figure out the concert starting on like May 17th at Ibahama Park Stage. So yeah, concert and animations. So not anything related to, you know, an animation project in terms of like a new anime series. Or
I think it's perfectly reasonable for people to be at least like disappointed at this one, because it, like, you know, like, Japan love its anniversary projects, especially 30th anniversary stuff like that. And I think UFO Table teasing something that far out, I think it was completely understandable for people to sort of get their hopes up. Oh, they're going to do a new anime adaptation of a Tales series because they've done it in the past.
No, I'm totally with you. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you know, they did.
The way they framed this. Go ahead, Adam.
Yeah. No, like, that Brian was basically framing it the same way. That's all I was going to say, is that, like, they were seemingly hyping this up. So the disappointment makes sense that it wasn't just kind of a off the cuff, hey, we're doing illustrations. This was their big announcement.
Yeah. Like, it's cool. Like, hey, I'm down for more new illustrations for Tails stuff, like a whole shitload, both in regular and chibi size proportions and all that stuff. Like, that's cool for all the Mothership entries, and I'm looking forward to seeing them. But of course, like, you know, did this really need the big hype up to it? Like, I don't know, especially because they said they're going to release like a new trailer on their YouTube, and it has like a whole time, like, you know, schedule thing. Like, and it's one of those things that, like, I feel like UFO Table has kind of, don't ever fall for UFO Table's lies ever again, because just before this, they were teasing something new with their upcoming Witch on the Holy Night movie, and they were doing the same thing. They were hyping it up, like, hey, we're going to have new information about Witch on the Holy Night at this date. We have a trailer ready and all that. So it's like, oh, cool, we're going to get a new trailer, maybe the release date of that film. Like, it's going to be great. You know, and then what it was like barely maybe like a minute long trailer, and it was just like showing a new key visual for the film, like a poster basically, with no release date, and that's it. And it's like, cool UFO Table, thank you. I mean, it looks nice, but did that warrant like this sort of like announcement and trailer for it? Look, I don't blame people for getting, you know, a little bit mad about like UFO Table kind of pulling everyone, but, you know, and getting them excited.
Make this huge announcement for a poster.
Like, what are we doing?
It's one of those things where, you know, if they had just kind of dropped that poster on social media, I think it would have been like, you know, people love key visuals.
Yeah.
Like, the how you message the message is almost as important as the message itself.
And in fact, kind of a tangent, but I actually really appreciate our friends at Nova Crystallis. They'll share like all the different anniversary art for all the different Square Enix properties. Like, they, you know, like I wouldn't see those otherwise, and they're not hyped up or right. anything. It's just like, hey, this artist shared like, you know, a 12th anniversary for Bravely Default or whatever. It's like, hey, that's cool. That's cool.
For sure. Yeah.
Art is cool. So Adam, thanks for leading the discussion on kind of just a check-in on, you know, the Tales series, Tales of Geala specifically, but also UFO Table, what we could potentially look forward to in the future from the series and all that.
I'm looking forward to Mikhail's review of the Tales of Arise on Switch 2. It's going to run perfectly, that's my guess.
I'm excited. I'm probably going to buy that from the Japanese eShop to get it earlier, because I've like had to do that twice based on how late Switch code has been. But yeah, I am very excited for that one.
Okay, Josh, here's where we've earmarked your mystery topic.
Oh, no. Okay.
You don't have to. You get back out without people forever be curious.
Yeah, it's too late. I can't keep on doing this. So I'm trying to think how to put this out. So for the past maybe 3 to 4 weeks or so, I started playing a game because I got curious, and now here I am, fast forward in time. I have like over 120 hours into it. And I've told no one what I've been playing. I've done my best to not even mention it, because I'm like, this is the type of game where it is the ultimate. Whenever I talk about things on this podcast of like good, like what I like out of like industry practices and what I dislike, it's definitely more of a do as I say, not what I do scenario, especially with this game. The name of this game is called Star Savior.
Starfield.
Damn it. That's awesome. No, it's okay.
Say that again. I didn't mean to speak over you.
Star Savior. It first launched about 4 to 5 months ago, I believe, in Taiwan and Japan. It is a mobile gacha game that is also available on Steam, and its global release came out like, you know, 2 to 3 weeks ago ish. And it is just like this weird, unholy amalgamation of like other popular mobile gacha games into one. And I think there's a lot of like different...
deliberately or is that just
definitely deliberately. I'll get into it. Definitely deliberately. And the its story, like the story of its release, is part of my fascination with it, because when it first initially launched in Japan and Taiwan, like, you know, almost half a year ago, it pretty much bombed. Like, it is, like, within the first, like, month or so, like, there was enough, like, scuttlebutt about it in terms of, like, how it monetized itself, its structure, and the way that, like, it wanted to squeeze money out of people was enough to, like, even get, like, its developers to apologize for the state of it and you know, adding in a lot of quality of life stuff to it. And what we received in global is pretty much it's not like behind in terms of content. It's launching with the same amount of content, and where the it's synced up to the same, you know, content wise as like Taiwan and Japan. It's not like starting from scratch on like where that game was initially on release. It's all synced, but there are a lot of like, you know, goodies, campaigns for global only to kind of quote unquote catch up that player base in terms of resources to where the other servers are. So even more so, like, it's a little like, I know people like throwing out this term a lot, but like even more so in this game, it's very, you know, generous with what it's like giving to new players in the global server, like, to the point that like even some players from other servers were considering starting over on our global server because what they gave out was so good in that regard. Where there was like free roles, a lot of free resources to build up your characters, etc., etc. Like, this game is a mixture of Honkai Star Rail in terms of like the way that turn-based combat is like basic attack, special attack, and ultimate attack, and there's like a break system for enemies. It's not to say that it's like imitating it one to one, but it's very much, you know, other turn-based RPGs have done this, but it's very much styled in that way. It also has a little bit of Goddess of Victory Nikkei in it, in terms of like it's a little bit of like there's like some AFK mechanics to it. There's other mobile games like AFK Journey have this, like, if you log off, it'll continually build up resources that then you just like collect every so often, like, you know, the resources that it's gathered while you're offline. And as well as like that whole same Nikkei like level wall system, and I think you'll understand what I mean by this, Chao, where there are characters that have like a level, maximum level, like 160, and to get over that level of 160, you need to get dupes of them. But like how Nikkei does it is you can technically get everyone, like, oh, like all the SSRs you got over level 160 without getting dupes of them all individually. You just need to get like any four characters that you have like the most dupes of that can all like get to like get past that level 160 wall, and you just put them in this Starlink system, which is called, that's what it's called in Star Savior, and you level sync everyone by the level of your lowest level Starlink fourth member. So what, that's a lot of jargon, so I'll kind of explain
it. I followed it actually.
I think this is common in Epic 7, I think
Epic, yeah, 7. I think Epic 7 also does it too. Yeah, so where when you pull like an SSR character, it has a max level 160 normally. If you get like a duplicate of it, it's their level cap will go up to, let's say, level like 170. You get a second dupe of it, it'll get up to level 180, you know? So, and if you get like three dupes of a character, their maximum level will go up to level 200. So what you want, ideally, is you want four characters to have three dupes, have four characters, have three dupes of each of these four characters, so they all have a level cap of 200. Then you slot them into this Starlink system, and then in everyone's level that you put in that Starlink system otherwise, like to connect to those four, will share that same level without having to invest the dupes in them. So if I want this, let's say I have this Emily, and I only have one copy of her, she only has a level 160. All the other, if I have a Starlink system of like four characters already at like, say, level 180, I can put her in there with them and she'll be level synced to 180 without having to get dupes of her because of these other characters already sharing their level with her. That's the most basic way to put it. Saying it out loud is like way more complicated than like what it actually is, now that I think about it. But that's the general gist of like where the Nikkei, you know, comparison goes in, because like people who play that game are very, you know, familiar with that infamous like wall of it. There's also elements of Uma Musume in it, where there is this big mode of the game called Journey, where you actually train and raise the stats of like your characters by engaging in these events, and you can level up their stats like strength, endurance, vitality, focus, and protection. And your main goal in that, like in Uma Musume, is to get them not only to build up their main stat as much as possible, but also get the benefits out of these Arcana cards, which you also gacha for. And they give like unique abilities, whether it's like crit rate plus 5% or attack or crit rate plus 18%. And then there's like, you know, some Arcana card might have like a class exclusive ability, like say for defenders, where they have a 20% chance to stand in front of another character that's about to get attacked, and they tank the damage in place of that character. And this game made me realize why people like Uma Musume so much in that regard, because I really, really, really dig the journey mode in this game, because there's... I'm always very interested in how different RPGs, no matter how they're monetized and what their format they're on, I'm always interested in how they find ways to how they build their progression systems and to serve the overall gameplay, like turn-based format. Because like in this game, it's like you have a party up to four, you have two frontliners, and then you have two backliners, and they all work together to serve their roles. Tankers, obviously, at the front will try to soak up damage, while the ones in the back have like more support roles, DPS roles, and all that stuff. But the way that you build them up beforehand really is important in how the battle is really shake out. So like you can have a defender that can reliably tank damage for other backliners, while this liner might have abilities that work really well when they crit a lot. So but they might have skills that like if you crit multiple enemies, they'll have like attack modifiers and new like ability options because they hit crit on there, for example. It's a very, very like more complex than you'd imagine game, and that's kind of like one of those that like weird poisons in my mind, where like if I start latching onto something that I find really engaging in terms of gameplay wise, I don't really care what the aesthetics of the game are if I find the gameplay engaging, because the Star Savior is very much, it's an ecchi game. Like you're the main character, he's like the only guy, the entire roster is just made up of girls, and they all have a lot of them are very scantily clothed, so a lot of them are catering to different fetishes of sorts, and all that stuff, and I'm like, that's it's totally fine if a game goes that doesn't really bother me. Like for me, I'm really here because I like the progression of building up my characters and challenging myself into like ever like more challenging fights. Like obviously the stats and the numbers only get higher. So it makes me think about like how do I clear the next hurdle and what do I have to do to get there? And sometimes the answer is like I have to redo some journeys for some of my main party because I got a new Arcana card and I want the effects of that Arcana card into my character. So I'll undergo their journey to, which is like a really fun game in its own right, to raise up their stats and get those special abilities from the Arcana cards into there. There's also like a gear system, which is somewhat similar to Epic 7. I wouldn't say it's as demanding as Epic 7 in that regard, but it's still very much in that same line where Epic 7 can get very min-maxy in terms of like, hey, every character can equip up to 6 pieces of equipment, and each equipment that you obtain will randomly reroll roll 4 substats, and obviously having good substats will make a world of difference on your character in the very, very late game. And after you get each piece of equipment, whether it's, one of the things, whether it's like boots or necklace or helmet, you can get them up to plus 50, which is their max level. But then you can also spend an additional like 20,000 gold, which is sort of a trivial amount, but you engrave it onto them. So only that character can wear that piece of equipment. And what you get out of it is like a plus like 15 or 20% boost in the main stat of that equipment as well. So it's very much min-maxing, their capabilities in that regard. You can still take them off, but you have to like undo the engraving on them. So I don't think you get your money back from doing that. Let's see. There's also on top of like the PvE aspect, which is like sort of like these, these operation stage nodes. There's also a PvP aspect to it. There's two modes of PvP. There's one that is like Princess Connect, Redive, which is like kind of like these automated PvP battles that you can skip, which is like Princess Arena in those games, which is, you know, very like, you know, you do them, win or lose, you still get currency, PvP currency out of them to buy from a shop, which is whatever. There's also real-time PvP, which I think like for the first few ranks, you do match up with bots, but every so often you'll actually get match up with a real person. And the fascinating thing about this is if you reach like gold rank in this real-time PvP, you start getting to a system which is like drafting like in MOBAs, where you do like pre-ban and ban phases before the PvP match starts with that other person. So you're forced to build multiple characters, not just like one main four party like reliable cast of characters, so because you're going to be forced to start to think outside of the box if you want to participate in this real-time PvP aspect, which, you know, I'm like, I know it's a big turn, like it's a huge deal breaker for a lot of people. You don't really get much out of PvP in this game, to be honest. Like, I think the most alluring part about doing PvP is that there's a PvP exclusive skin that you can gain if you're like you're at least rank gold or rank platinum by the end of the season, which ends like in, you know, a month or so. And you know, it's obviously a very like scantily, very, very scantily clothed skin for an existing character. But it's just one of those things, like some people like the PvP aspect. I kinda dig the whole drafting part of it, because I used to play MOBAs back in the day, so, and MOBAs have a big, like, you know, pre-ban, ban phasing when you're constructing teams in that regard. So I was like, oh, that's really interesting that if you're going to participate in this earnestly, you are forced to think of teams that wouldn't excel well in PvE that would do well in PvP, because the dynamics of PvP are way different than what you would build for PvE in this game. It's one of those games that I would recommend to no sane soul. It is definitely one of those games that like strikes the exact target zone of like all the things that I like about RPGs, but it carries a heavy amount of baggage. Because obviously it does a lot of, like, it has almost every set of, like, mobile game monetization in this. The only thing it's missing, it's, like, a VIP system, which is, thank God. But this game has, like, it launched with 5 different battle passes, and it added 2 more recently. It looks crazy at first, but 4 of these battle passes are progression-based, so, like, you'll level them up as you are completing like the operations and hard operations, which are like the single player stages, and you'll level them up, like, you know, just through progression. But obviously all of these battle passes have a free track and a paid track, so, you know, the abyss is endless there. Then you also have battle passes besides those progression passes for just a general one when progressing through the game. One that is for the Uma Musume journey, and one that is the Gauntlet PvP side of it. Once again, I'll have a free track and obviously a paid track. And if you really want to whale, by all means, you know, this game gives you a lot of avenues to squeeze money out of you if you want to go there. It also has a lot of like cash shops and options. And then whenever you reach like a point, whether it's like reaching a certain aspect in operations or getting to this floor in the tower or whatnot, then they'll also have like an additional, like, you know, we're offering these goodies for you for 2 hours only, and here's like the efficiency that you can get of these bundles if you decide to buy them within this limited 2-hour window. Like I said, a lot my brain is fortified against that, so I'm not susceptible to it. Because I've seen it before. I know how I am with these games. I won't submit to temptation and that aspect. But there is, like, you know, for me personally, I just like find a lot of this game fascinating. There's like, it's juggling so many systems, yet it still is coherent in a really compelling way for me, because I do like difficult turn-based combat systems. And this one strikes that like perfect target zone where I feel like the amount of effort I'm doing in all of the ways I'm like building my characters does pay off when I'm getting over the hump of like a really hard stage, because I'm like, oh man, the turn order really worked in my favor. I was able to break this boss at like the perfect time, so now I have access to like my support character to heal me up, and I can do, go boom 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 with my characters. And there's a lot of things going on that eventually I get over this wall, and it feels satisfying. And I'm like, not a lot of games kind of give me this kind of satisfaction, so I'll take it where I can get it. In that regard, the gacha system in this game is also the amount of like free pulls and goodies that you can get from a global, like when you first started out this game in global. I shit you not, they're pretty much giving out, if you're playing through this game normally and doing everything in this game, you'll get easily over, I feel like a fucking ad saying this, but you do easily get over 1,000 pulls in this game just by playing it normally and like without putting a cent into it. And because we're launching after its initial state in Japan and Taiwan, you do get a lot of the quality of life upgrades that they apologized for and fixed in those. So this game feels really, it's one of those games that like I kind of feel like I'm cheating almost the devs on the on how much I'm getting out of this game, because this game first launched with, I believe, like a 2.5% SSR rate, and they bumped that up to 4%. And Chao, you understand what I mean when I say this. But because of at first, this game didn't launch with a 50-50 or a pity or mileage or anything like that, so it was fucking rough. Like, people did not like this game because they felt, you know, that's just like really fucked up in this day and age of like, you feel like you're getting cheated on.
If you lose the 50-50, you basically end up paying like twice as much to get the unit, right?
Yeah, but right. There was no 50-50 and no mileage in this game at all. Like, you didn't even have that. There was not even... So, the change... So, on top of the upping the rates to 4%, which is a relatively high compared to other games, they did not add a 50-50, but they added mileage in this game. So, for every 200 pulls, you can exchange that for the featured banner unit. The thing about this mileage system is those points don't expire, so you can save up that mileage for as long as you want, and it'll be applicable for every future featured banner. So like right now I have like almost 400 mileage on my account, and that means that if I wanted to get a character that is they call it Cosmics in this game. In Nikkei, they call it Pilgrims, which are special characters that when you... Normally, when you pull for a character, it's when you get that 4%, you'll have like a somewhat of like a high chance to get the featured character. But for Cosmics or Pilgrims, they have a much lower rate because they're more like... I don't know what the reasoning is, but they're like more specialized characters, especially for PvP. But some like Cosmics are like very good.
This is Epic 7 all over again. Yeah. Basically, there's alternate versions of characters that are like very good for PvP, but not really good for PvE. And they're like super hard to get. They're like 10 times harder to get than regular units. And back then, when the game first started, there's no 50-50 to get them. And the only way you get the rolls to get to roll them is either you beat the game and you get this currency, or you have to spend 120 rolls to get... one roll on that character, and the rates are like 2%. So if you got one, your account's like worth like a fortune. But nowadays they add a lot of pity system to get the units now, so their values have diminished a lot, but they're still hard to get. So it's the exact same example.
Yeah, so for like, you know, like since I have like almost like, you know, 400 points, like I for this mileage, I can just save those up for like those hard to get characters. Like they're like, hey, this is a new cosmic character that's like fucking awesome in both PvE and PvP. So I can use that mileage instead of like hoping for the rates to go into my favor, because these mileage points don't expire. And like people will still play in the Korean server and in other servers, Like, I've seen some of them, like, have, like, over, like, 2,000 mileage points because they don't expire. So they can basically get any character and dupes of those characters that they want because they have so many points. And that's the way that they sort of flip their gacha system around, where it's actually kind of... I know there's all relative because it's all picking, like, you know, my shit is better than your shit, and but they're all shit in that regard. But it does feel... it does feel good still pulling on this game, because even if you don't get what you want in a certain amount of pulls and there's no pity, you're still building mileage for either the character that's featured or for a future character that you want to save up for and you want to use it on. There's also the same, like, it's also shares the same with Arcana cards, and Arcana cards are their own, you know, hell that I can get into for another half an hour, which I won't. But these cards are things that you use for the journey mode that I mentioned earlier, and you can they share the same mileage pool with the characters, so you can, like, save that mileage up for an Arcana card that you want as well. And like I said, it's like a unholy mess of systems and progression and stuff that, like, would normally be unfathomable for a regular person. But unfortunately, I'm not a regular person, and I have a decent enough understanding of, like, how mobile game systems work and how these different systems work within this game, that, like, it hits this sweet zone in my brain where I'm like, man, this is, if you put in the time into it, you do kind of get a lot of fun out of it. And that's how I've gotten, like, you know, over 120 hours into this game, because, like, I genuinely find a lot of its, like, modes really fun, and I don't feel like I'm really cheating myself every time I, you know, make progress in this game. And it's just, like, in general, it's just, like, it's just a fun game to play, and that certainly helps when, because we got so many quality of life improvements from the lackluster failed launch of it when it first came out, you know, almost half a year ago in other territories. And I don't know, it's one of those games, like, I was like, should I ever tell anyone that I'm playing this game? But here we are. That's Star Savior. I'm generally, I don't know, I still like it a lot. I want to stay with it for now. I don't know when it's going to fall off. I'm sure, you know, all these games fall off eventually, but for now, it's really interesting also because, like, the company behind it is Studio B-Side, and they previously made Counter-Side, and people really like Counter-Side as well. And I think there's, like, a certain somewhat, you know, recent update to that game that, like, a lot of people fell off of it, but for many years, people seem to really like Counter-Side. And it's, like, it's a smaller studio as well. It's not, like, it's not as comparable to, like,
I never played it, but a lot of people that I know used to play it, and they tried to tell me to come to Counter-Side. You know, my cousin got addicted to Grand Blue, and he had, like, the most craziest count too, and he was like, I've converted to Counter-Side, come play Counter-Side with me. I'm like,
nope. But yeah, that's Star Savior. Like I said, it's you have to know what you're getting into, and do not try it under my recommendation. I do not recommend it for you. If you think it's for you, it's not for you. And then give it, like, if you're going to download it and give it a try, give yourself, like, 5 hours and see if you still like it. And if you don't, stay away from it. Get the hell away from it. Because, like I said, this game is very predatory in terms of, like, all the ways it's trying to squeeze money out of you. But if you know who you are and you know what person you are, then by all means, it's just, I don't know, man. I'm very weak to, like, interesting turn-based RPGs, especially when it tries to cram so many systems into it that feels like it shouldn't work, yet it somehow comes together in the end. Fuck, it's. I definitely, like, understand why people, like, can't. Yeah.
Speak to it, like, specific to, like, this style of game, but thinking of, like, the best, most challenging, most rewarding turn-based RPGs are the ones where you have to learn every system. There's nothing extraneous. Because the worst feeling is when a game is bolted together in a way, whether it's turn-based or not, where there's a system that's completely like superseded by another, or like, why would you ever do this when you can just do that? But, you know, when a game is smartly designed and all the systems, you know, interlock in smart ways, the games that I'm thinking about right now, like when you're playing a challenging turn-based game and you only have exactly the amount of resources you need to win, I'm thinking like the back half of Fantasian. I'm thinking like the challenging battles in Last Remnant. And obviously it's not one-to-one.
You know what games are the exact opposite, that where systems feel like hodgepodge and don't mesh at all and kind of feel useless and pointless and suck? Half of the outlet from FooRyu.
Of course, there's an audio podcast, but I'll share a picture that I'll describe in our chat. But basically, one of the big hurdles in this game is chapter 18, stage 36, and you need to beat the stage to get the hard mode difficulty in the journey mode, and that's like a big threshold to get to, because hard mode in this game rewards a lot of stats. It's definitely difficult at the beginning to like overcome, but it's one of those modes that like you cannot ignore to build your characters properly.
So this is the bottleneck you have to get through to get that.
Yeah. In the screenshot, it's basically the boss is down to like maybe 1% of its health, and they only have like 2 tanks left, and their HPs are basically zero. They're like, there's one tank that you see 46 HP on, and normally they'd have like 35k plus HP up until that point. So they are living through the skin of their teeth, and I'm like, it just so happened to like, you know, be at that perfect sweet spot of like, okay, everything worked out in my favor at this try of the fight, because I definitely had to do it several times to where I was able to finally beat it and overcome this wall, and that felt really good. At the end of that, you can also check like your battle statistics to see like what are the damage, shield and healing breakdowns of each of the 4 characters that you do. And you know, it's very very much like, you know, like a MMO raid like style statistic of like how are people doing in this fight, and that feels really really satisfying, you know, like I won't sugarcoat it, man, it felt really good. I was like, fuck, that was awesome.
You know, I'm addicted to playing Grand Blue again because I finally decided to read the entire main story and to access the hardest boss available right now. And because I cleared it, now I have an addiction because it's so addictive fighting these stupid endgame raids.
Yeah, I mean, look.
I finally did it.
You did it. I'm proud of you, Chow. You did it. But yeah, I'm, you know, like I said, I don't always dismiss these games. Sometimes I tried this out on a whim because I heard the global release was coming out, and even though I heard bad press about it, I was like, I'll still give it a try. And I didn't think I'd be into it, but here I am. I think it's really cool, and I think a lot of it really works for me.
With that, well, the next thing that we have listed here is, Mikhail, you kind of put it here, PS5 Pro stuff. So I'm not sure what you had in mind here in terms of like, I think, are you the only one on the podcast? Does James have a PS5 Pro?
No.
I'm trying to think like who actually here has one.
I was going to try to buy it, but they were all sold out.
Yeah, ciao.
We're on Panic Buy.
Anyways, what do you have in mind for your PS5 Pro discussion?
Yeah, sure. So last week we discussed the price increases where everything's getting more expensive. Okay. Yeah, so... over here, the PS5 Pro hasn't actually launched yet. It was just like import stores getting their own stock from like Europe, Japan, and wherever they could. When they announced the price increase for like all the consoles, even the base PS5 was like sold out over here and no sign of new stock. Now, my plan was always to get a second PS5 at some point. I just like kept pushing it because like other purchases came up or whatever. And like we finally upgraded like my dad's iPad and all, like he's finally got an iPad Pro, like the latest model, and he's been using like the iPad Pro first model, which I think is now 10 years old. So like got all that done, and then I was like, you know, I want to get a new PS5 in June, probably like when June is like a little light month besides news and stuff. So I was like, okay, let me do that. They announced the price increase and I was like, shit, am I gonna like get this sooner now? And should I just get the base PS5? And then, like, after the podcast or whatever, like, the next day, I just made some calls to some stores over here. And I was like, what's the situation? And then, like, one store had two PS5 Pros in stock. That's it. Like, I couldn't find any stock anywhere else. And they had it at the old price, which was still quite a bit, like, compared to what I wanted to pay. Like, I'd say it was about $150 more than I wanted to pay. I just said, screw it. Let me rip the Band-Aid off. So I picked it up on Monday morning. And then I was like, what am I going to do with this for work? Besides, like, you know, actually, like, it's essentially like a GPU upgrade. So I was like, what am I going to do with this for work? So I was like, let me just talk to Alex and figure out. So I have some stuff in the works. But the main thing which I'm going to be working on is like how we have the Steam Deck RPGs and the Switch 2 RPGs list, which is going to be updated over time. I'm doing one for PS5 Pro stuff. And yeah, that's basically, I started work on that and I downloaded like 3,400 GB of games in the last 4 days to like just plow through and stuff. So wanted to just briefly touch on some impressions. Obviously, I'll save most of it for the article, but just some notable differences which I found. The biggest one being FF7 Rebirth. I still think the game in performance mode on PS5 is dog shit. Like, it's so blurry. It has awful textures. So when I loaded up the game over here, it actually, like, I didn't realize it loaded up the original PS4 base version. And I was like, is this what it's supposed to look like? Because this doesn't look better. And then I found out that for some reason, the game defaults to the old setting. So I went and changed it and I was like, okay, now it feels like a PS5 game, not a PS3 game or whatever. So I started playing Rebirth again. And then I just downloaded a lot of other games, trying out like games which haven't been optimized, like FF14 and FF16. They're just like using the like brute force, essentially seeing big upgrades over there, trying out some gacha games, which I've only played on my phone, like Arknights Enfield, and which has PS5 Pro support, which is really good. I played Wuthering Waves also, which doesn't have support, but that just runs badly. So like, I deleted that. Like, I'm not wasting 110 GB of the SSD for that. And oh yeah, the other reason why I got the Pro and not the base PS5 was I need more than 1 TB of storage on my console for like new games. And like, looking at the price of a 1 TB SSD is like, yeah, it would have cost me more than buying the Pro over here. So that was another reason I got that. And I was like, you know, I'm going to be like covering a lot more games on PS5 soon, so may as well, like, including one next week, which can't talk about yet. But yeah, like, there's just a lot of other games coming out. Like, I've also re-downloaded Resident Evil 9. Not an RPG, but yeah, that was something interesting. So I just like plowing through stuff. Like, I downloaded Expedition 33, which looks a lot nicer. Oblivion is still really bad. Like, I don't know. I think, Brian, you played that on PC, right? Like, you reviewed it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, but I think I still kind of brute forced it. Like, I didn't, like, first, I played it a few months after it launched, so I think I got spared the worst of it, but even then, it wasn't great. I just kind of gripped my teeth and went with it.
Yeah, like, it's still the same even here. Like, regardless of what you played on, it just has that loading stutter and the hitching. Like, that hasn't been fixed, but yeah, thanks to the brute force, it just runs at a higher resolution, so that's nice. Then I downloaded Where Winds Meet, which is also a very big game, like 120 GB or something. I played a bit of that on my phone. I feel like a lot of these gacha games, they're just like leaving the game uncapped, like putting on ray tracing and just leaving it uncapped. And if you have VRR, good for you. If you don't, too bad. So that was another thing. And Dynasty Warriors Origins is like one of the biggest upgrades I've seen so far, because I thought the game ran really well, like brought it up how polished it feels and all. Like, it even runs well on Switch 2 and Steam Deck and stuff. But that, like, looking at the upgrade over here, like, it, I don't have to choose between like clear visuals and like blurry visuals and 60 FPS. Now I just get both together. So that was nice. And it has a 120 FPS mode also, which I was like, you know, maybe I should play the DLC in this mode and see how it is, because like, I was playing it on Switch too. So there's that. Baldur's Gate 3, the main city still drops below 60 FPS. I think, like, nice. You really need like some super high end CPU for that, and like the Pro does not have that. But the funniest quote unquote upgrade so far is Metaphor ReFantazio. That actually runs at 60 FPS locked now. It does not run at 60 FPS locked on any console besides this. So that was super funny. Yeah, like just working on that, like been like downloaded Dragon's Dogma 2 and Monster Hunter Wilds also. Those just kind of benefit from not using FSR to upscale. So like you actually have like good image quality now instead of like blurry image quality. So probably will publish this thing like in a week or two once I've tested like stuff like Stellar Blade. Inazuma 11 is 4K 120. So like I resumed my like long playthrough, which is still going on. So that was like funny to see that. And Kingdom Come Deliverance 2, just like downloaded a shitload of stuff. Assassin's Creed Shadows is another like massive upgrade compared to the base PS5 because it has like all the ray tracing stuff enabled. So you don't have to like choose between what looks like a PS3 game and what looks like a PS5 game when you go through the modes and stuff. So yeah, like between this and the Switch 2 boost mode, I'm like enjoying like revisiting older games for a bit. So that was my PS5 Pro. Yeah, why I got that and like stuff that I'm working on.
I'm trying to imagine in my mind's eye, like your entertainment center, like you have your PS5 next to your PS5 Pro, in the drawer is a Switch, next to two Steam Decks, next to a ROG Ally, next to...
Yeah, well, I'll post a picture of your dedication. How haphazard it is, but yeah, the PS5 Pro, the PS5 Pro is like on another side of the desk because like it's a big console, but it's not as big as the base PS5. Like it's somehow smaller than that, but these are still really big consoles. Like, so the big problem is my Xbox Series X, which I haven't been able to fit like on the same desk, but yeah, like I need a new desk. I should go to IKEA. So yeah, That's where I'm at right now.
Before we go on into news, we're going to turn back over to Adam just briefly here. Adam, I know that you over the last week, grit your teeth and got to work and wrote up a few of your like final preview and interview impressions and opportunities that you had when you attended GDC a few weeks back. So I'm not going to like tell you which one to talk about, cause I'm not sure like which one of these was like what you took, you know, the most meaning or interest away from versus the others. I do obviously have all the articles here linked, but I just didn't know if there's one specific here that, you know, meant more than the others or, you know, what you'd like to talk about first.
So yeah, basically at GDC, I had an opportunity to do a few previews, a few interviews. Some of them we already talked about, like with Crimson Moon from Probably Monsters. But so this week, I guess start with this one. So one of the things that when you go to events like GDC, that's nice is that there's lots of different mixer type events with like smaller developers or indie developers. And so like literally they'll have like, you know, a conference floor or room or even hotel lobby just full of, you know, different developers, usually small developers, just showing their games and just trying to get, you know, they're trying to just the stuff they've been working on for years and years, trying to, you know, put it out there in the world. One of the games I had a chance to check out was from Hypersect, which is called Never's End. And this is an indie game. The creative like CEO and founder of the studio is Ryan Jukit, who is he was like a sandbox designer on Destiny, and now he's running his own little indie outlet here, developing this tactical RPG. And I think we might have mentioned this on previous podcasts, but anyways, this tactical RPG has it was sort of like a guided preview. I was playing the game, and it was a demo that is available on Steam right now that you can download and play right now. But he was just kind of telling me, you know, guiding me through it, the philosophy towards the game and things like that. And so this is a tactical RPG that is very mechanics driven. And he described it as a combination of like classic Final Fantasy Tactics style, as well as a game called Battle Brothers, which I had heard of, but I'm not like very familiar with. And the way he phrased it was more or less like, you know, lots of different interlocking mechanics and systems and considerations and properties that all have to come into, you know, consideration when you're like planning your, when you're playing through the game, you're planning your party and you're progressing through battles, all these things come into mind. So right from the get-go, when you're playing this demo, even if you just look at some screenshots of the game, it, like there's a lot of icons, there are a lot of numbers, there are a lot of symbols, and you're like, what is all of this? So it's a very dense game, and like intentionally so. And he showed me like there's a help system in the game that you can pause the game at any time, so you can highlight over an icon or a number, and it tells you like what it's doing or what it means, which is really nice. Like, it isn't locked away in a tutorial menu or anything like that. It's just basically a button you can press to kind of go into a help mode that just highlight over anything, and it'll let you know what it means. Probably the most interesting mechanic to the game that feels unique to me is how the magic system works in this tactical RPG. So rather than just, like, casting, like, a fireball or an ice spell or a tornado, how it works is you, like, manipulate the weather. And so you pick, like, a tile, and you're like, raise the temperature of that tile, and then you pick a different tile to lower the temperature of that tile, and you're messing with, like, the game's, like, pressure, like atmospheric pressure in the world. So it creates, like, wind that goes in certain directions, which you can use this to, like, knock enemies off of cliffs or into each other or into a cliff or into the water or whatever. If you drop them into water, they'll get wet, which makes them less likely to hit you. And then if you raise temperature enough, they can catch on fire. If you lower temperature enough, they can basically be encased in ice. And there's all these different properties that can come into play. For example, enemies that have fur are more susceptible to fire. If there's an enemy that has, different weapon abilities also, or weapon types also, like slashing, piercing, blunt, and things like that. And different armor has different properties that how well they can defend. For example, if someone's wearing like a metal helmet but a leather like tunic, they'll take more damage to the, I believe if I remember correctly, they'll take more damage with a hammer to the head than they would to the torso. But if you had like a slashing weapon, they take more damage to the torso than they would to the head. And so you kind of have to know where you're aiming. So all these different considerations in play. Definitely very dense and very tactical. The part of the game that I'm like, that's hard to get a grasp on in a demo is that it's like procedurally generated. So you go through different tiles on the map that are not like AI generated or anything like that, but kind of like somewhat randomized, that have like different like zones and different like elevations and, you know, layouts and enemy spawn patterns and things like that you go through. And you kind of go through these squares, battling enemies, powering up your troops and things like that. So I could, in the demo, I could basically get a pretty good understanding, like, okay, here's how the combat works. Here's how my like class party building works. But the one thing that I'm not so sure on, which is not really even in the demo at all, is like, okay, so what's the long-term like macro structure of the game? Like, what are you proceeding towards? What are you progressing towards? And that wasn't so clear to me. But
yeah, I remember in my demo with it at PAX West, there was almost like a floating island stage node thing where like if you want to get to like the next like zone, like there is like an overall like stage map but you do have like some agency over, I want to go in this direction for this next zone.
Yeah.
But like you said, it's hard to get a feel for like what is the overall objective to where you're going when you're making these decisions. It is like you said, I definitely think it is such an interesting game mechanically in that regard, especially the magics.
And there's other things also, like if you create wind on a stone block, it's just wind. But if you create wind on a sand block, it creates a dust storm, which if you're inside, mm-hmm. you're standing inside of it, it can blind you. So there's like all these different like, and the way that he put it also is that like it's for the magic system. It's meant to be a tool that if you know how to use it, you can use it really well. But if you don't know how to use it, you can hurt yourself. Like if you're putting wind in the wrong spot, or if you're like causing the wrong temperatures, like the wrong tiles to be higher or lower in temperature, and you don't know what you're doing. And so he kind of considered it like you have to know, this is magic that you have to know how to use it, not just cast fireball and put it in that direction. So that's kind of the philosophy there.
Indie game, Zend, right?
Never just Zend.
Just to restate the name.
Yeah. And he told me he's been working on it for about 7 or 8 years. He says he's had like off and on like 4 to 10 people working on the game. Contractors, you know, with various, job tasks and things like that. Probably one of the more awkward preview interview opportunities I had was for Mongol Star Drive. Mongol Star Dive. This is from Netmarble, which is a publisher and developer of high quality games. That's a joke. That's their tagline.
I get it.
Sorry. Yeah. For the audience, I don't actually believe that. That's literally their tagline, is they are a publisher and developer of high quality games. Anyway, Netmarble is a Korean studio. They have various like sub-studios underneath Netmarble. This is actually from Netmarble Monster is the studio. And I had a chance to interview with the CEO and boss of the studio, Ken Kim, making this game Mongol Star Dive. If you haven't heard of this game, it basically, to me, looks like Genshin Impact, except it's Korean, not Chinese, and it is with like a monster taming, not really taming, but monster catching element. So it kind of feels in the realm of all those like anime style gacha games. And me interviewing, I knew this going into the interview, I don't really play these sorts of games. So to me, I'm not really the best person to like, you know, have a fine tooth comb about like, what are all the, like the differences between what this offers and what other games offers and the subtle like differences and nuances between each of these games. They kind of blend together to me. And I understand that's probably not ideal, but I had the opportunity to do this interview. So I got a chance to ask them about, ask Ken Kim and Netmarble about this game and what they're doing. And basically the way that this interview kind of took place or how it carried out was Mongol Star Dive is a follow-up to Netmarble's previous game that came out 10 years ago, which was called Monster Taming. Literally, that's just what the game was called, was Monster Taming. It was localized into English under the name Creatures Academy back in like 2014. However, I actually figured out after the fact that I guess there was like a comic book also called Creatures Academy or Creature Academy or had a really similar name that was like, there was like legal action made because they had similar names. Yeah. And eventually Creature Academy, like this game, the English version just got removed from storefronts and never replaced. Like it just, because of this legal issue with its name, just got removed and it died. Like, I actually did not know it existed. I kind of, either if I knew it, I forgot. Anyway, so this is a follow-up to that game. And the way that he kind of framed it was like, he kind of framed this game as being, you know, a natural evolution of that game. And I actually even, one of the questions I asked Ken Kim about Mongol Star Dive, and I thought this was a fair question, was like, we're seeing a bunch of these sort of anime-style, free-to-play, you know, RPG-type games. Not to imply that they're all the same, but we're just seeing a lot of them. So I asked him, like, how does this game, you know, what sets it apart? Like, how does it stand out against all these other games? And he kind of felt like he was, like, really defensive on his answer. Like, well, this is nothing like Genshin Impact. This is more like our old game, Monster Taming. And where you have, you know, our three-person action combat system where you're chaining together actions and things like that. And I got to play a little bit of the game. You basically have three characters that you pick from a pool of, you know, dozens. And the kind of the cadence of the game is that you are doing certain abilities as one of the characters to line up some sort of chain. You switch to a different character to kind of complete to continue the chain. You switch to a different character to kind of continue the chain. And you're trying to combine their abilities in such a way to stack the damage, you know, to as many multipliers as possible to do as much damage as quickly as possible. I know we've all probably played games with similar mechanics. I think Genshin might have a similar mechanic to this, where you're chaining between different abilities from your party. But anyways, yeah, so I asked him a little bit about how it stands apart from the other games. Probably the more direct answer to that was that there's a monster catching system where you have like this, you have this little black cat with big eyes named Nanners. That's N-Y-A-N-N-A-R-S, Nanners. And he can, like, has, like, a black hole in his mouth, and he can, like, suck up monsters into himself, and he captures monsters, and he turns them into little, like, accessories. They're called monsterlings, and these accessories all have different stats and, like, properties that they do. And so part of the game, like, mechanics is to capture these monsters, you know, that whatever your playstyle is or whatever your characters that you latch onto are, the idea is to capture monsters that benefit you the most. And I think you can have up to three of these monsterling accessories. So you want to basically make sure you have the right properties, make sure that they complement you well and things like that. So I kind of get that broad idea in terms of like your theory craft, character building sort of stuff. But yeah, that was it. It was, like I said, a little bit of an awkward interview because he spent a lot of it basically saying like, this is nothing like the other free to play game, and I'm like, are you sure? I didn't mean to imply that it was like. So I have seen some pretty harsh comments online calling it a ripoff, and like, to be clear, I didn't call it a ripoff, and I wasn't implying that. I just was genuinely asking, like, you know, how does your game stand apart? You know, what makes it unique? What does it do? And he did answer it, but he was very defensive about it. Maybe he got that question a bunch, which is fair, I think. Anyways, that's that. I just posted a picture of Nanners sucking up a monster. Like I said, he's got like a black hole in his mouth. Anyways, the probably most interesting interview I had was with the team behind Zero Parade, which is that studio is ZAUM. I actually learned how they pronounced it, if you're curious. That ZA/UM is pronounced ZUM. It's just one like syllable, ZUM. It's like ZUM. It's not ZAM. It's not ZUM, but kind of like ZUM. But yeah, one syllable. Now, if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably aware that the studio ZUM, they were the studio behind Disco Elysium 5 or 6 years ago. But about 3 or 4 years ago, the creative leads behind Disco Elysium, Robert Kurvitz, Alexander Rostov, and Helen Henpierre, alongside other people, were all fired from the studio. Robert Kurvitz and Alexander Rostov actually posted their perspective about what happened. They claim that the studio was basically switched ownership, possibly illegally, and due to this like new leadership that actually ran the studio, they fired these creative leads. So that's what they allegedly say. And there's actually legal, proceedings going on behind the scenes literally right now about this. So regardless, those creative leads behind Disco Elysium are not working on Zero Parades from the same studio. And you look at any post or YouTube video or Steam forum or whatever, you'll see this people calling it a takeover and all that stuff, which I'm not saying this didn't happen. I'm not saying that's not misplaced, but I had a chance to interview some of the writers who are still at ZUM working on this game, the new game Zero Parades. So I knew going in, okay, they have this this basically cloud hanging over them about what's going on with the studio over the last couple of years, but I also want to make clear that these are like the writers. I'm not accusing these specific people of any wrongdoing. They're just trying to make the best of things with what they want to do, which is write a game. But of course I wanted to ask them about like, how is this, working in this environment? So the interview that I have with, let me get their names. Cause it's, one of the writers is British, Honey Watson. One of the writers is from Estonia. He goes by Cosmos as a nickname.
Nickname.
Yeah. So he is Slim Cosmos Sinemaye, I think is how you pronounce it. Right. So I interviewed these two people about Zero Parades as well as Disco Elysium. And I basically asked them quite a lot of like philosophy questions in terms of like, how do you approach writing an RPG like this? What sort of feedback did you see from Disco Elysium that you wanted to incorporate into this game? How does this game differentiate itself from Disco Elysium? And I might have mentioned this in a previous podcast, but one thing that kind of caught me off guard is one thing I asked was like, how does it differentiate itself? And they said, well, it's a completely different genre, which caught me off guard. And I'm like, wait, it's still an RPG, right? But what they meant was it's a spy game and not a detective game, which to them they considered it in terms of like literary genres like very different. A literary novel or a detective novel is very different from a spy novel. And they mentioned some of their another thing that also kind of caught me off guard was I asked them about like I specifically asked them, besides Disco Elysium, was there any other game that you felt like was an inspiration to Zero Parades? And immediately, they didn't give game answers. They gave like authors, like novel authors, Thomas Pynchon, Ursula Le Guin, John Le Carre, Philip K. Dick. Like all of these are like 20th century short story writers or novelists, especially in like spy or science fiction genres. So that was their immediate answer to me asking about influences. You got to keep in mind these are writers, so the first thing that comes to their mind are novelists. and how they're approaching the game. I asked them things about, like, if a player is making various choices and building their character differently with their stats, how do you reconcile that? And I liked their answer. Their answer was with great difficulty and pleasure in terms of trying to, you know, predict or account for all the different ways that a player might approach a game and how they have to basically write around that and kind of account for every possible permutation of how a person might, what a person might have experienced in the game or who they talked to first and second and all that, which I think is a really interesting topic. And then, of course, I did ask them the difficult question about, okay, considering the state of the studio and the fact that the original creative leads are no longer there, why should people, like, why should people trust this game and play it? Why should people not dismiss Zero Parades? And their answer basically was, they want the game to speak for itself. They just want you to play it. Just try it. And Cosmos actually answered to me, if you don't like it, you don't like it. That's fine. We're not making Disco Elysium. We're making Zero Parades. And then this answer that I got from Honey, which I think a pretty rehearsed answer. I think they gave it to many people who asked them because I'm sure they were expecting this question. What she said was, we're less interested in arguing that we're able to make a good game than we are in actually making one. Which is fair. So again, these are the writers. So they're kind of caught into this, you know, the situation themselves, and they're just having to make do with how they can, right? So that seems like a healthy attitude to me, is they're just controlling what they can control in terms of, we're just going to do the best we can do and hope people give it a chance. And I couldn't really ask them any, not only can I not like ask them much more about like the studio situation, these aren't the right people to ask, but also I was told that because of legal proceedings going on behind about the studio, that they couldn't really say a whole lot more than that. So, but I thought it was a really interesting talk.
Asking the question, though.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I think it was a really interesting talk. It's kind of a long form interview. They have pretty lengthy, in-depth answers. So check it out if you're curious.
And it's not the writer's decision here, but it is a little bit, you know, whoever made the decision, you know, higher up in the studio, that they are very clearly trying to leverage, you know, I think Mikhail brought it up a couple weeks ago, like if you load up Disco Elysium, it says, try our new game, Zero Parades, you know, from the creators of Disco Elysium. It's like, well, yes and no, but, you know, the writers didn't have a say in that.
Now, I'm sure there's some people who are maybe, like, extremely cynical, who might like, accuse me or somebody, like, why did you even give them, like, the light of day? It's, why do you even talk to them? You should just shut them out. Or if the studio has this allegation behind them, why do these writers even work there and not somewhere else? And it's just kind of like, you know, sometimes this might be the best option for them right now. Like they're just doing what they can. I'm giving them a chance, the writers a chance to say, what do you feel about this? And, you know, now we have some insight there. So I am definitely not trying to just like put the studio's actions under the rug. If I had a chance to interview leadership at the studio, I'd probably be more hostile. Not right. Hostile is not the right word, but like I would probably be like, what's going on here? But the writers, these are the writers. This is the chance for them to say their mind. And so now Zero Parades actually did get a release date. I think it's probably on our list. And I don't know if I'm going to play it because it kind of feels bad. You know, I like meeting with these writers, but with the studio itself, with this kind of cloud over it, you know, it's a weird spot. Like, I don't know if I want to spend money and buy this game and support it, right? You know, so.
Yep. And yeah, we do have it listed here. They did announce that it is launching on May 21st for PC.
One other thing that was an interesting discussion in the interview. Let me make sure I pull it up, the answer here. So I actually asked them, Honey and Slim, what types of RPGs they like to play. You know, I was just curious, you know, how they're approaching this. And Cosmos, or Slim, gave a pretty interesting answer where he's like, I am a big RPG head. I'm very much into classic RPGs, but I'm from Estonia and I grew up in the 90s. And back then, we didn't have like game consoles. Like we had fake Nintendos and all this stuff. So I could not, he basically implied that he could not get these games, like he couldn't buy them, not legally or not easily. So he even just admitted, like, I played a lot of these games on emulator. I played all the Final Fantasies. I played Chrono Trigger. I played Pokemon. And then he also said, like, he played, like, the Diablo series and things like that. And I thought, I just thought that was an interesting, you know, anecdote about here's someone who grew up in a time and in a country that, you know, was underprivileged when it came to access to games. And so this was a case of someone getting into the hobby and into his profession through emulation and playing games, buying games for playing on his computer. And he even said, like, even having a computer back in the 90s in Estonia wasn't, like, a given. So he admits that he was lucky, or that he appreciated that his dad had a computer so that he could do this. So I just thought that was an interesting perspective of literally a person getting into his job because of something that, or access to stuff that he wouldn't normally have access to, like, through, you know, official means. And also, one thing that was kind of amusing was they're talking about what the other answer from Honey about this, about what sorts of RPGs they like to play, was Honey was like, well, I actually am a huge fan of Elden Ring, and not necessarily for, like, the combat stylings for it, but how it, like, tells a story. And she even kind of joked, like, not to say that Zero Parade is like Elden Ring, because that would be a funny headline, but using, you know, a game as a vehicle for how to tell a story, you can do some things with it that you couldn't do in a book, or pure, like, just a page-turning book, or in a movie, or whatever. Like, having that interactive element to it in terms of how a game works, whether it's like Zero Parades or Disco Elysium, or whether it's like Elden Ring, was something that drew her to writing for games in the first place. So I thought that was an interesting answer.
That was a good answer.
And then to kind of cap this off, Mikhail, you did put up one of your, you know, one of your specialty articles about, you know, platform comparisons, and you did it for Disco Elysium, which ever since its release has found itself on a fair number of platforms at this point. So I guess, like, what is your, like, key takeaway returning to Disco Elysium now that it is available on, you know, PC, PS5 Pro, Steam Deck, all those things? You know, what your main takeaway was?
So before getting to that, I found it a bit funny that when I was putting together the cover stories on the front page, it was like the left thing says moving on from Disco Elysium, and on the right is like, which is the best version of Disco Elysium, and I found that super funny, so I just left it like that because I was like, that's cool. But yeah, so the timing was like, basically Disco Elysium, the final cut, which added all the voice acting, added like more story content, and basically polished up the game, added controller support. I think they added better UI scaling and stuff, a lot of stuff. Basically, it turned 5 at the end of March. And I had this thing like ready a while ago. I just like had it, wanted to go up for the 5th anniversary. And the main takeaway from that is that every version of the game still suffers from a Unity bug, which means that camera movement is just not smooth unless you play the game on PC at 50 FPS or 100 FPS. Because it uses a stock Unity physics thing, which has affected like a ton of other games, like Super Monkey Ball on Switch before they fixed it, Dave the Diver. And it's kind of similar to the Pixel Remaster issue, where the camera is moving at a different speed than the playable character, so the scrolling just feels off. My main thing about this is obviously like testing how it loads and stuff across every platform. But yeah, the only version I'd recommend people play if they can is the PC version, because you can actually cap the frame rate and get smooth movement. And this is not something I think will ever get fixed now with what's happening with Disco Elysium and with Zaum, if that's how you pronounce it. I think I forgot how to do that. But yeah, so that's the thing, like, because I know that when this game is coming out now, a lot of people are going to wonder about Disco Elysium. Even with Esoteric Ebb, everyone calls it a Disco Elysium. Like, I'm sure there are people who still haven't played Disco Elysium, and, you know, obviously, like, Switch 2 back compatibility. So if you have the option, like, just please play it on PC and do the, like, limit your frame rate. Otherwise, I just can't get over how, like, it just feels like you're, regardless of how good your setup is, it just will not feel smooth. I don't know if any of y'all have played or heard of Star Wars Dark Forces, you know, the classic FPS game.
Yeah.
So that game, it kind of has a similar issue in the remaster, that because of the spaghetti code or whatever, that game can only be smooth at 72 FPS or 144 FPS, because of the tick rate or something like that. So the only way to get smooth movement on that is if you're playing on a Steam Deck OLED. Oh, I think it's not 72, actually. It might be 51 or something. I'll just like double check that. But yeah, you can limit that on PC. So if you play it on PlayStation 5 at 120 FPS, it still has that hitching here and there. So this is like one of those issues which you can only like fix if you had like granular control over your refresh rate. And it's a shame that like one of the best RPGs of like so long is just, it has this issue which is never getting fixed, but at least you can fix it on PC. So that's the main takeaway.
I didn't expect that the main takeaway would be Disco Elysium is like Star Wars Dark Forces. That's the takeaway. But no, thank you, Mikhail. And obviously thank you, Adam, for a very in-depth interview with the developers still at Zelm working on Zero Parades that is releasing in May. Did you ask them what their favorite coffee was?
I did not.
What a disappointment. I'm just kidding. But no, still a very cool, very insightful, and kind of in some ways like a tough interview. So thank you for putting that together and having it up featured on the site at rpgsite.net. With that, at this point, we'll go into the news. Not a huge like slate of, you know, of news headlines this week, but a number of things. A handful of trailers seems to be.
You forgot
kind of heavy
the other interview.
There was another interview. I thought I went through them all. Oh no, I did skip one. I apologize.
It. Yeah,
too many URLs on my little cheat sheet here. You had an interview with Jason Charles Miller, and if that's not a household name, remind us who this is and what you got to speak to them about.
So he's a musician, composer, voice actor who most people listening to the podcast probably know him through the vocals on the Shadowbringers theme, some Endwalker vocals as well. And if you've played Metal Gear Rising, he sang Rules of Nature. I think that's what like everyone probably knows. So yeah, like I got to interview him about like his voice acting, the music he's done for games. He also did with his own band called Resodrone, the cyberpunk, you know, the Resist and Disorder, the song that plays when you're like shooting and when you get to the afterlife and stuff. So I had like a half an hour call with him to just discuss his FF14 stuff. He's the reason why the Rage Against the Machine collab happened with FF14, because when I covered that in the interview as well, like he knows Tom Morello because they do some charity stuff together, and he brought up that Sokin is a huge Rage Against the Machine fan, and then he introduced him, and then that's how you have like Dawn Trails Raid has that wrestling theme, Everything Burns and stuff. So just slowly going through his career, his solo career, how he got in touch with Konami, he was put in touch with like, you know, Cyberpunk, they got in touch with him, stuff like that, and just generally how it feels traveling the world playing with Final, like he's going to be performing at FanFest with the Primals play now. So just like chipping away at all those different things. Was working on this for a while, actually. Finally, with schedules lining up before he went on tour, got a chance to do that. I did like 3 interviews that week. So like this is one of them, which is now up. The other one will hopefully be up this week. So yeah, if you like enjoy Final Fantasy 14, you've probably like heard his voice quite a bit, because whenever they do those Primals concerts, and like these are like Close in the Distance and Shadowbringers are like 2 of the most popular songs now for that. So yeah, and it was funny that this whole interview, I initially just pitched it because when I was replaying Cyberpunk, I was like, this song sounds fantastic, let me just look it up. And I saw Jason Charles Miller and I was like, oh, this is the Shadowbringers guy. And then when I clicked on that name on Spotify or whatever, and then I see Rules of Nature, and I was like, holy shit, he did that also. And then I went down this like rabbit hole of like the insane range he has. And I was like, yep, like, let's do this. And that's how it happened.
Like once a year, I still pull up the Metal Gear Rising soundtrack just because there's really nothing quite else like it. But
yeah,
no, real cool interview opportunity.
Timeless.
There, Mikhail. Yeah. So yeah, rpgsite.net, you can find all of those features, the James Charles Miller interview, the interview with Zelm, the interview with Ken Kim from Netmarble, Never's End, and all of those. With that, and thank you for stopping me, we'll go into news. Not really any like big first thing must mention, you know, at top headline here, but I did put something that I saw a fair bit of traction on social media as a pretty exciting announcement. Breath of Fire 4, now available on Steam. Not the first time it's been available on PC. It was released on GOG last year. But Adam, I know I came home and chatted with you on Discord. You were messing with this. You were playing around. You're trying to, you know, take some notes about Breath of Fire 4. What did you kind of find out? What's interesting about this announcement?
Well, first of all, and I think we mentioned this recently with like Dino Crisis and other Capcom games, it has the Enigma DRM, which is kind of just like, really? Come on, guys. Yeah. You don't need this. It is what it is. I'm assuming, hopefully they remove it in like a couple of years, I guess, because it seems like they do that. They just keep it up for a bit and then they remove it. I don't know. It's like unneeded. It's not necessary. This game, if you wanted to pirate Breath of Fire 4, it's been available on the internet for decades. But the biggest thing, though, is when Breath of Fire 4 came out, I guess I should start it with this. The original 2004 or whatever year it was, PC CD-ROM version of Breath of Fire 4, because it came out for PC back when it launched, or shortly around its, you know, after its launch period originally, that original PC CD-ROM version that you could get back then had a bilinear like filtering filter put onto it so that the visuals did look a bit more like smoothed compared to like the PS1 version. So like that was kind of like inherent to the PC version even back then. When the game first released on GOG last year, it was more or less that PC CD-ROM version. It had like better resolution options and things like that now, but it still had that filtering, and people noticed right away, like, oh yeah, this game doesn't look the same as the PS1 version. And then like I think it was like 1 or 2 days afterwards, they updated the launcher so that you could do like different like point sampled filtering or like visual filtering instead, which isn't exactly like the PS1 version, but still like way better in terms of maintaining that pixel art style. Because Breath of Fire 4, if you haven't seen it, is one of the best looking games on PlayStation due to its pixel art. So the fact that you have like this smoothing filter on it kind of sucks. And I'm like, okay, that's great. When the game was released for Steam, if you look at the Steam page and at the developer, it says Capcom and GOG.com. So it's like, oh, okay, so GOG, who worked on this game as part of like their preservation program, were involved in this new modern PC port that's now available on Steam. However, it was the Steam version was missing that like that point sampled filtering that was added to the GOG version for some reason. It's actually kind of weird because like if you boot up the Steam version, it actually has a brand new launcher. It's actually a pretty nice launcher that gives you like all the different like resolution options, aliasing options, and things like that, which for like a PS1 game back then is like, this is pretty good. But it was missing that point sampled filtering, which is like probably like the one thing you want to make sure you set, and it just wasn't there. And it's like, that's kind of that's a bummer and also a little bit puzzling. Like, why is it not there? However, people have found that you can force it on through the INI file. So if you do that, literally just adding some text into like a text field, you can get that, which is like, okay, in one sense, problem solved, but really this should just be an option. So that's like, I'm hoping
all it's fixable.
Yeah. Like I'm hoping they just like, all you need to do is like, heck, even I could probably do that as a programmer, like add a dropdown to like add that text to the INI field and just set this dropdown and then it adds it for you. Like that's all you need to do is make it a dropdown in the launcher to set that filtering. Which again, it's still not exactly the same as the PS1 version. You can see comparisons. So like, if you're like a purist, you might just say, no matter what they do, it's not as good as how it looks on PS1. So just play that, which is, I guess, fair. But yeah, that's just kind of like a weird omission that it's like not in their launcher, because it's like the key option you'd want to set.
It's also worth mentioning that that along with the other along with the classic Resident Evil trilogy that they added on the Steam, all of them have the Enigma DRM as well.
Yeah, I mentioned that. Yeah, which is just kind of.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
No worries. It's like a bummer. Like, you don't need this. Yeah. It's $5.
Yeah.
And I don't think we stated it explicitly, but like the GOG version doesn't have the DRM. And I mean, yeah, that's, you know, if you know anything about GOG, that's obvious. But just explicitly, that version is the same game without the DRM. So there you go.
The thing about Capcom and their DRM is they always launch new games with de novo. And then they eventually remove de novo and replace it with Enigma. Enigma, like, based on what I've been reading, de novo is a lot more expensive. And I think they just use that to, like, protect their launch sales, which makes sense. Because if you can prevent your launch getting whatever cracked or whatever, you're fine. I believe, like, there have been people talking about de novo not being as useful anymore, even on that front. But that's, like, not my problem right now. But yeah, they seem to be removing de novo and replacing it with this. I think like having Enigma on this is like dumb in general, like you've already covered. But the other issue is that, you know, like how Breath of Fire is missing that option, because even the Resident Evil and Dino Crisis games, apparently on Steam, the GOG developed versions, they're all like not the up-to-date GOG version. So they're all missing some features which GOG patched in and fixes and stuff. So like you're literally getting the worst possible experience by buying them on Steam. You're getting DRM, you're getting non-fully updated versions. And except for Breath of Fire, which I think Resident Evil 3 also is a bit okay, but it's a bit jank, none of these games work on Steam Deck. So like Resident Evil 1 and 2 do not work. You have to go and do some file editing in desktop mode and download some third-party program to run some launch command. Otherwise, it doesn't work. Breath of Fire 4 has this weird thing where you have to bring up the keyboard once in a while to like get through, because while the GOG version has full controller support, like when I bought it on GOG, it just worked without any issue. But on Steam, you have to like press escape and press something else randomly, and I just got irritated and deleted it. And yeah, you're literally getting the worst possible experience by buying these on Steam instead of GOG, because usually when you have these other launcher games coming on Steam, they make a big deal about like Steam Deck, you know, it works on Proton, Steam Deck verified, full controller support, Steam Cloud. None of that is here. There's no Steam Cloud also. Like, what are you doing, Capcom?
And absurd,
this is from a company which apparently like loves Steam. So like they just seem to like do anything they can to like irritate the audience.
Games without Steam Cloud, that's super rare nowadays. It used to be like back in like 2008, 9, 10, like 9 out of 10 games at Steam Cloud. At least that's, you know, that's not math, it's just my memory. But now it feels like 99 out of 100 games. And when a game doesn't have it, it really throws me off.
There are some like big exceptions, like the Dark Souls trilogy. I think only Dark Souls Remastered has it. I don't remember if 2 and 3 had it. 3 didn't have it when I tried it, because I remember downloading it on, when I just got the Steam Deck, I was downloading all the old games and I was like, where's my save file? It just said new game. And then I looked it up and there's no Steam Cloud. And the other one game which really annoys me at not having Steam Cloud is Inti Creates Dragon Mark for Death. And this is something which every time I email Inti Creates PR for whatever, I always like, PS, please consider adding Steam Cloud to this. It's just become like a running joke. They probably ignore it, but I hope it, like 50 emails or whatever in the last few years, I hope it actually happens. But yeah, like not having Steam Cloud on a new game is just, yeah.
Did they ever add Steam Cloud to Outward? I remember that was one game that didn't have it, and it was like,
I don't remember. That's the game I want to revisit before the sequel.
I don't know. That's what I'm getting at. It's like the sequel, like, will that have it? I remember it was also just kind of just like, it was just like a personal like philosophy, or not, maybe not philosophy, just like opinion of like the creator. He's like, I don't like it, so I'm not gonna do it. Like, okay.
Was this Outward Definitive Edition?
Yeah.
Well, Outward. I don't know if they added it eventually, but I know it didn't.
I never played the Definitive Edition. Yeah.
Okay, it's like, I just see the Steam forum is just people saying, when are you adding Steam Cloud?
Oh.
Like 2022 and 2023, so it probably wasn't added. There's another publisher that just does not add Steam Cloud to most of their games. The ones who did the Buckshot Roulette, a Critical Reflex. Yeah, they make a lot of really cool indie horror games, and just none of them have Steam Cloud. So like, it's just...
It's weird.
Just so annoying. I think, did you play that game Arctic Eggs? It's like a fantastic game which you use like motion controls or the mouse control to like toss eggs and make them for people in this weird...
I'm familiar with Critical Reflex, but I haven't played that game.
Yeah. So you should try that out. But yeah, that game, I remember seeing something like, you know, a roadmap, and they said, yeah, we're looking into adding Steam Cloud. And like, it's just a toggle and you have to add the save file path. There's no like extra work needed. I don't know why it's such a big deal. And this is not even like me speculating. I've spoken to devs about this, that it's super easy to add Steam Cloud. It's just, I wish Valve would force devs to do it, but they just seem hands off with most things. Unless you're like an anime game or a visual novel, then they're like, yeah, we'll pay attention.
One other game that we talked about already was, I don't remember the details specifically, but the Oblivion remaster has Steam Cloud, but it has some weird misalignment with where it's expecting the Steam Cloud save to go.
So, and I, if you look up the Reddit from last year, it probably has talk, like, you have to take your Steam file, move it to like another directory, like where Oblivion originally put the save, and then Steam will see it. It was very bizarre and it was very frustrating. Like, it was someone, like, they implemented Steam Cloud like incorrectly or something like that, or in some weird way. But yeah, it's one of those things for you take for granted when it works well, and then when it doesn't work well, you're like, oh man, I miss it.
I'm seeing people bring it up as of like March 17th, which is like 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, where there are like threads on the Steam forum saying, Bethesda, are you kidding? Where's the update? Fix Steam Clouds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so yeah, this unfortunate that like a remaster, which I absolutely love how it looks and feels, but they, except for like those performance issues and these kinds of things, it's like just baffling. They were happy to talk about like 4 million players and stuff, but like, where are your basic fixes?
So the long story short, play Breath of Fire 4 on GOG or PS1. A handful of trailers here, and I know this, you know, an audio podcast, so not a whole lot we can kind of glean from these, you know, detailed. But we got a story trailer for the new Sword Art Online game, Echoes of Aincrad. I did not watch this trailer, but I did see someone mention, like, I got spooked when Kirito showed up or something like that.
Kirito dope scare.
Yeah, basically. So yeah, it's a story trailer that, you know, if it's the first arc of Sword Art Online, right? So, but obviously adapted into the MMO that the anime is, a single player game framed as an MMO based on the anime VR MMO.
I know it's been a few weeks and this is not really related to this article, but I still have to complain about that. I hate the new YouTube embed layout. I hate it so much.
Yeah.
Like, I'm like, where's the volume? I'm like, oh yeah, it's the top right corner now. And everything is just like, I hate everything about the new YouTube embed.
You know what? I saw some speculation that they changed the play button and they put the share button over there because that shows that there's more engagement now. And that's the best way where people can get, like, all these companies will get people to interact with this stuff. Because even on Google, like on the Gmail app on iOS, the profile or the account switcher, they move that a bit to the left and they put that stupid Gemini button over there.
Oh, yeah. God.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
That's how they get us.
So, yeah, every time I say YouTube embed thing now, I just get pissed because of the new layout. I know it's been a few weeks, but it still makes me mad.
We got another trailer for I think it's an indie game, Songs of Glimmerwick. I saw this trailer and it's releasing this year, and I was like, did we cover this game before? And I looked and we last covered this game. Adam wrote a news story about Songs of Glimmerwick back in 2022 when it was slated to release in 2023. Clearly that didn't happen, but you know, making games is hard, so no judgment rendered. But they recently just gave a new gameplay trailer for this game and stated that a desire to release the game this year for PC and consoles soon after. It looks like kind of a cute, like, painterly styled kind of cozy RPG of sorts. So I don't know, I looked at this and it looks very it's kind of like very comfy, very cozy RPG for later this year. We got a gameplay reveal video for Mortal Shell 2. The original game was kind of a Souls-like that released back in 2020. They announced that Mortal Shell 2, I think last year at Summer Games Fest was when it was first announced. So we got our first kind of look at gameplay at the sequel and also an announcement that it'll have an open beta at some point this summer on Steam. Remember, I forget if it was last year or the year before, it looks like last year, those like early 2000s action RPGs called Fate, were originally PC games that got reported to all consoles as kind of like a Fate reawakened early last year. So it's kind of a cool just kind of preservation thing for kind of a niche fan base of games. All those released in March is like a quadrilogy or whatever you call it, Adam, tetralogy. Four pack. It's getting like a new DLC, which is always kind of fun to me, even though I don't have any attachment to these games specifically. When a game, you know, that had its heyday a while back is now getting new content added to it, shows that someone was really eager about it, whether it's the original creators or not. It's just, I don't know, it's always kind of fun to see those sorts of things. So it's getting a new DLC called the Prometheus DLC, inspired by Greek mythology. And do we have a date for this? Got an announcement that the DLC is coming, but I don't know if it actually gives us when it's going to be added. I actually don't have that piece of information. trailer's only 20 seconds long. Something like, does it say? It does not say. No. So I don't think they've announced a date. They just said you can wishlist it now. Starfield, of course, has been in the news for the last couple months or so. They've got that second story DLC coming out. It's launching on PS5. It's getting a free lanes update that's launching alongside the PlayStation version. We got a new trailer showcasing the PlayStation 5 exclusive features. I think there was a lot of, you can now see like the new, like, what is it, achievement list related to all the new updates. So Starfield, I think we'll kind of see at this point next week because it's all launching on April 7th. So we'll know this within a couple days, kind of like all the details about this. But we'll see if this like breathes any new life into Starfield. We did have that preview from Scott from last week, not last week, last month, about the new DLC, which is called Terran Armada. And I will probably play it because I did play the last one. Which I'm actually just blanking on the name.
Shattered Space.
Shattered. Yeah. This one. Yeah. Anyone who owns that.
Oh, the new DLC is free? The Terran one?
If you own the premium edition of Starfield or you bought the premium upgrade, the new DLC is free. Otherwise, it's $10.
I don't know if I got the premium version or not, but I'll probably play it just because like I feel like, all right, I played the last one. I'll play this one. So I'll probably report on this in a week or two. So
I'm curious about that because I did not play Shattered Space. I just played Starfield in launch month and never went back to it. And I will hopefully be playing this and talking about it. But yeah, I'm very curious.
Shattered
about
Space
that.
Felt like I never wrote a review for it or anything. I don't think it really warranted an independent review. It felt like the worst sort of like early 2010s, late 2000s DLC, where it's like this could have just been a long quest line sort of thing. Like it wasn't bad, but it wasn't better or worse than anything else in Starfield. It could have just been its own quest line. It added a few things with like the void creatures and void grenades and things like that, but not anything really more substantial than that. So we'll see if it's the same tack for Terran Armada or not, but we'll let you know. A couple updates. I think the last time I was on the podcast, we were talking about the relatively recently announced Kyoto Xanadu from Falcom. We kind of got our first like character biography rundown in early March or late February. I forget the exact timetable. We got basically the next set of characters here. Kite put together a pretty thorough kind of almost dossier about 12 new characters.
Did he just update the previous article or?
I think he just updated. Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, that's what I'm missing here. Okay. Yeah. So, okay. I see this here. So it was first in February, first five characters, then four more were added in each month, February, March, and April. So up to, it looks like a total of 17 now. So in April, it looks like four more characters were added to the list. So I guess good on Kite for keeping kind of like a kind of a living document, so to speak, of the voice actors and the characters in Kyoto Xanadu.
We've kind of joked in the past, like Falcom's like marketing cycles, like first they introduced the playable cast, which is like, yeah, that's a very fair thing to do. Like then we'll introduce some like main characters and villains. And like, yep, that's a fair thing to do. And then like they get to like these NPCs in this one town and then NPCs in this town and then like these NPCs that like say maybe like four sentences in the game. It's like, okay, you don't need to go this granular here.
This person upgrades your gear, they are a shop menu or whatever.
I
think it's just like, you know, every news drop of it is like, well, there's still another week without the news of the Western release of this game and who they partnered with. Get that sorted out. It's like its release date is, you know, not too far off. It's inching closer and closer. Still no new news
July.
Of the Western release. Yeah.
I had the cursed thought the other day that the English localization is being handled by P-Cube.
Ooh.
Should I import this game or should I just wait for the English announcement?
You have to import it so you can get started on your guide.
True.
I never promise a guide.
Do what you want, Chow. I don't know if I'm gonna import this. I think I'll just wait.
I'm gonna import Trail Second for sure, though. Not Chow is gonna get ripped off by whoever's
handling
the physical again.
I'm never buying Unlimited Run again. Never. You wait like 6 months before you get that, and you always get like email a week saying we just start production. It's like next week we just start production. It's like what? It's like did you say that last week?
Yeah. Look, eventually one of these beasts are going to start production, okay? You know how Broken Clock is right twice?
Yeah, you keep calling someone Fred. I'm sure that guy, you'll encounter a Fred someday.
Adam, before we, I forget this was before we were recording today or late yesterday. You saw this news about Elminage 2, but I don't really have the context for this. Like, I can read it to you, but I don't really like know it intuitively. Was this something that you were following along with?
A little bit. Yeah, so, no, that's fine. Elminage, if you haven't heard of it, is a dungeon crawler RPG series. There are, I believe, 4 games in the series, although some of those games have been like re-released like on different platforms and different versions. It's a very, very wizardry. Like I know people say like Etrian Odyssey is wizardry like, which it kind of is, but this is like very like almost as direct of an influence as you can get. Very hardcore dungeon crawling RPGs with that sort of Western aesthetic from a Japanese developer. So the games that are available in English are Elminage Original, which is like a port of the original. So it's not Elminage 1, but it's like a version of Elminage 1. And it's now available on like PC, Switch, or it's coming out to Switch soonish. But anyways, Elminage Gothic, which is one that I played, that's the 4th game in the series. Now this is Elminage 2, and basically Starfish, or whoever the publisher was, let me pull it up here, said they're planning on making like a new version of this. I think it came out on like PSP or maybe 3DS way back in the day. So they basically said they have plans of doing a re-release of Elminage 2. So it's never been available in English, and this isn't an English announcement, but they're doing something with it. Oh yeah, PC and current consoles, and it's actually I get a little bit confused, like who is the developer and the publisher on these games. So they kind of like swap hands. So it looks like this is, yeah, publisher is Starfish and Mebius. So
it's not announcement of an English version, but...
No, it's not English at all. It's just a Japanese announcement saying they're going to make this for PCs and consoles. Ah, okay. But that makes it... If it's coming to PC, it's like, are they going to have an English version? Is it on Steam? Or is it just going to be like some sort of downloadable, you know, version from a website? I don't know.
And it looks like also, you mentioned that Elminage Original is coming out on Switch later in the month, April 23rd.
Yeah.
Sales updates, Crimson Desert has sold 4 million copies. I think it was 3 million last week or 2 weeks ago. So still selling pretty well.
Yeah, they also released like an update, like, I think yesterday or something. That
yeah, kinda 4 million patches. Have gone.
God.
Wait, what did the new update add? Anything notable?
I see Mikhail and Josh like posting new updates in the Discord every other week or whatever, or every other day. And I feel like I'm not with it because they're like, oh, I can't believe they did that. Oh, they changed that.
So the notable things about the new patch that released like yesterday was the storage chest that they added at a previous update. And after they relocated that, now you can expand that storage chest up to 1,000 slots, depending on how many camp expansions you have. So you get a shitload of storage space, which before it got any patches, there was no sort of storage at all. It was all your inventory beforehand. They added like a fast travel point in Peilun, which is like a sort of like mid-game main area that you go to. It's sort of the Dragon's Dogma 2 comparison that we always do, where they added a fast travel point for real at, what's it called? The desert area.
Bak-tal or something like that?
Yeah.
They added one new armor set and helmet for cats, which is always huge.
Hell yeah.
They added a new movement option. That was like the thing where you can run now by holding a button instead of mashing it like GTA or whatever.
Yeah, so which like was, when I first talked about this game, like I mentioned that inconsistency of like if you like there's like different rules of when you want to sprint. Like if you want to sprint just like normally on foot, you just have to do the double tap and it'll do it for you after that double tap. But then when you're on horses, you always have to keep on tapping to sprint, which is like a weird inconsistency. And then, you know, the game's gone through many, many changes since that initial launch version. And now they have, like, a basic movement option and a classic movement control. Basically allowing you, like, if you want to use the basic, you just hold the sprint key to accelerate. If you use the classic one, you just rapidly press the sprint key to move. And then you can apply that to, like, on the horse as well. You know, it just it keeps on undergoing like big revisions. You know, the headgear visibility being now an official option in the game. There is used like some PC mods for that. Because, you know, a lot of games, when you have helmets on, you can choose to turn it off. You want to see your character's face and head. Then eventually, in a future update, they'll allow you to hide the weapons and stuff on the character's back, because people don't want to see your shield or your bow and arrow on the character's back. Maybe you just want to see, like, the mantle or the cape and look cool. That's not in this patch. That'll be in a future patch. But I know a lot of these, like, you know, have been unofficially added via PC mods that they're now officially integrating into the game itself without having to mod.
There's some weird thing with the console versions where if you play on PS5 or PS5 Pro or like Xbox also and your monitor is not 4K, instead of rendering at the maximum resolution, it does this weird like lower resolution and then it upscales it forcibly. So which gave, like, it was weird with that. So they heard that feedback and they fixed it like a few days later. But that patch is only live on PS5. So the Xbox version is still, apparently, like, it has this weird upscaling. Like, I think the best example of that is if you all played Dragon Quest XI on PS4 when it came out. It had this weird shimmery foliage whenever you walk around. Like, they never fixed that.
Oh, yeah, I vaguely remember that.
Because it was rendering at, like, some lower resolution, upscaling it, and then upscaling it again or something like that. So that's what's happening in Crimson Desert on Xbox, which they said they'd fix in the next patch. So they fixed that on PS5 in the last patch, not this current movement option and, like, the patch which you're discussing, the one that. So I don't know, like, the team is probably, like, crunching, like, mad on this stuff, because these are huge updates coming every few days, getting through certification on consoles and stuff, so...
Yeah, I don't know if they're going to take a break. There's some updates like break, like, you know, like there's like one of the past updates broke like the ray reconstruction for a bit, and so they had to go do work to fix that up because of an update that broke that. Eventually got that fixed, but then like the next day or two, it's just like, man, I can't even imagine what the conditions are for the development team on that. It's like, especially because when you like they said like a good chunk of these devs already have moved on to the next project, which is like Dokev or whatever, which was announced way long ago. So I imagine they still have, like, I don't know if it's a skeleton team, but they definitely still have a dedicated support team on this. So it's and I imagine that team is, you know, way less than how many developers were on it full time.
The only other thing left are a few dates. We already talked about a few of them, like Zero Parades and things like that. Vultures, Scavengers of Death. This was a game that Adam was. It was at Haze that did the preview for this.
Yeah. And interview
like earlier in March or last month. An interview, right? So that'll be releasing on Steam at the end of the month on April 28th. This one I didn't know much about, but it feels like it's a big headline to me. Heroes of Might and Magic Olden Era is a new Heroes of Might and Magic game. I guess the first new entry in over 10 years is going to be entering Steam Early Access on April 30th. Looks like it's developers Unfrozen, publisher Hooded Horse, and Ubisoft is also involved in some
fashion. Yeah, it's like Ubisoft like owns the IP, but I guess there's an agreement that Hooded Horse can publish this Heroes of Might and Magic title, even though that IP is still owned by Ubisoft. As far as I understand.
Yeah. A lot of my friends are very excited for this. Like, I used to play a bit of Heroes of Might and Magic back in the day, so I might even check this out as well. It's been getting a lot of buzz underneath the hood.
Yeah. So, and we don't always cover, like, you know, every Steam Early Access update, but, you know, announcing that a new Heroes of Might and Magic game will be playable, not only on Steam Early Access, but the Microsoft equivalent. What is that called? Let me read it in the article.
Xbox
Microsoft Game Preview. Yeah, Microsoft Store Game Preview or whatever. So it'd be playable and, you know, at the end of the month. So real cool for old heads who are fans of Heroes of Might and Magic.
Yeah, for unks, just say that.
There you go. A game that released in March in Japan, R-Type Tactics 1 and 2 Cosmos, is going to be releasing in the West on June 18th for Switch 2, PS4, PS5, Xbox Series, and PC.
I'm very excited. I can't wait for this one.
I think it releases the same... Wait, you said June 18th, is that right?
Yes.
I think that's the same day as Adventures of Elliot.
There you go.
Man, that's a tough choice. I like the demo for that, too.
You're the space tactics guy. You got to do that.
Space tactics. Oh, you're preordained.
There's a big game, though. Like there's a lot of fucking stages in this game because it has like the original releases of the
one and two.
And then there's also new stages just for this Cosmos release. It's a big fucking game.
Josh is going to beat the PSP games just for research.
Man, I don't know where the PSP is at this point, man.
And then the last one we have is Another Eden Begins. We'll be launching on September 17th.
Another game I'm very excited for. Yeah. This is an interesting one because they showed off, they introduced the game, its English voice acting and characters, also the other side characters will be joining you along the way. But then at the very end of this trailer, they kind of do the thing what Cygames does with their Granblue console releases. Well, they'll give you a code for the original mobile game, and it's only for the Steam version of this game. If you get it on Switch or Switch 2, you do not get this serial code. And when you use the serial code from Another Eden Begins into Another Eden, The Cat Beyond Time and Space, which is the original game for mobile and also on Steam as well, you'll get an encounter ticket for Remyu, which is an original character. They're introducing Another Eden Begins, so we don't really know much about this character. But it's kind of a weird, like this, you get this character exclusively if you buy the game. I can't imagine this character is going to be like game changing or anything, so you don't gotcha for them, you know. And then they also get the new outfits that Aldo and Fine wears in Another Eden Begins back into the original Another Eden mobile game. So, you know, standard stuff that, like, you know, sometimes Cygames does this with their Granblue releases. Or you get goodies in the Granblue browser game if you get like Granblue Versus and
Granblue Relink. So I have a question for you, Josh. Like, so why can they do this and Cygames wouldn't do it on Steam for buying their game?
I don't know. That's the thing. I have no idea why this is only applicable to the Steam version, but not the Switch and Switch 2 version.
So they said on the Japanese Twitter account, they said that the codes will be there if you buy the Switch and Switch 2 digital or physical version. And for Steam, it says applicable for even purchases outside Japan. So I think the codes are not going to be available for the Switch and Switch 2 versions outside Japan is what I'm taking away from this. But it is for Steam.
Yeah, but Cygames does it the opposite way.
Oh, yeah, no. So yeah. Cygames, I think the reason why Cygames didn't do it before, but they might be able to do it now. Are they doing it for that Endless Ragnarok thing? Because now they have that Cygames ID thing, right? So they can just verify your ID and give you one code so that it's linked to your ID and that's it. Because that was the issue, right? If you bought it on, if you bought the Steam version and you refunded it, you'd be able to just keep doing that and getting those codes. But if they link it to your account, you can't like exploit this. So I think if they force you to use that Cygames ID, it should be fine. That's like my takeaway from it.
Yeah, I don't know, Chad. Have you heard anything about how Endless Ragnarok, if they're going to do that again for Endless Ragnarok or no? I haven't kept up.
I haven't heard anything. All I heard was the beta test.
Yeah, I tried the beta and it was like so blurry on Switch 2. And someone linked me to some impressions where they said it looks crisp and clear at 4K. And that's then I went to sleep. Yeah.
So the weirdest thing about the serial codes, aside from, you know, getting this character, the outfits, and, you know, some gotcha tickets and just whatever, is you get a code to skip part one of in the Cat Beyond Time and Space story. So their logic is, the more I think about it, is the story that they're telling in Another Eden Begins is already covered as part one in the original Another Eden mobile game. So it's one of those things, like, if you want to continue the story after you finish Another Eden Begins, you can go into the mobile game and you'll use this code and start where that game would pick up after you finish it. And it's like, I kind of wonder about the logistics of this one, because you do get a lot of like mobile game goodies as you're progressing the story in it, will you just get those like retroactively because you get them all through like an achievement system technically in that game? And where will your party be at if you skip that? Because they can't obviously still be level one, because the main story at some point does ramp up in difficulty, and you are expected to have a well-built party, both of the characters that you do obtain, also the characters that you gotcha for. At some point in that main story, it does ramp up in difficulty, where you need to have like a pretty competent party built up. And this also kind of gives me the impression that they might not intend to adapt future story arcs of Another Eden as a console game, if you're pulling this move, which is kind of a bummer, because from what I understand, main story part 2 in Another Eden's fully completely wrapped up. I quit before it finished, but it's been several years now, and I believe it's been wrapped up, and they're now on part 3. I don't know where they are in part 3, whether that's wrapped up or that's still ongoing. I don't really follow Another Eden stuff anymore. But I want them to continue this thing that, like, hopefully it does well and it motivates them to continue to adapt future story arcs as their like standalone console game. The other weird news out of this that wasn't really heavily publicized was on their Japanese Twitter. They also announced that Another Eden Begins will have a DLC character pack that'll add 10 characters. And it's being released through 5 ways, so 2 characters at a time, essentially. And that info has only been announced on a tweet on their Japanese Twitter, nowhere else, which is weird. But these are all characters that have showed up in the original mobile game. It's Tiramisu, Claude, Elseel, Wenefica, Victor, Thilaliel, Issica, Benedict, Yifa, and Ashtir. I had to go search up their names, because like I remember their designs, but I don't remember their names. And it's kind of interesting, because like I think the latest character out of these was added to like the mobile game like at the end of the year 2023, I believe. So that's kind of that kind of starts to give you a rough timeline on when this project was either in its early stages, or at least there was some significant movement in finalizing what content will be in the game at that point. So I'm still very interested. I liked what I saw in the trailer. Like, it's very much familiar with what I've played, but obviously a lot of new UI, a lot of new ways you get around the world compared to like how it was structured as a mobile game. And I saw like, you know, definitely some side characters in there. I'm like, oh, they're including this character, so they're gonna have like this storyline in it, because there's a lot of like side story quest arcs in that game that you can, you know, easily include in this game as like their own side story, side quest arcs. I was like, I can't wait to revisit this as like a its own thing.
And that kind of covers us for all of our headlines and news for this episode of the TetraCast. So still made a pretty full show out of it. But yeah, I think the feature of the headline of this week was kind of like all the different features that were put up on the site by both Adam and Mikhail. So if you go to rpgsite.net, and you know, we have all those cover features that Mikhail make sure are aligned in a artistic format are up there at the top. But if you also hit the articles tab, you should be able to find all the previews, all the interviews, all those up on the site, rpgsite.net. You can find us on all the social media platforms. Just search for RPG space site, and you should be able to find us. Join our Discord, discord.gg/rpgsite. If you listen to this podcast on whatever podcast service of choice, leave us a like, leave us a rating. We love to see those. We will be back next week with another episode of the TetraCast. And usually this is where I ask, like, what's on slate for next week? What is middle of April looking like here? I guess we got Starfield.
I guess it's kind of nice on our website now. The My RPG list has a permanent link at the top now. I can click right to it.
It does. Good job. You've only been doing it for like 8 years.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Next week we have People of Note, which is like that Annapurna like musical RPG, turn-based RPG. Sigma Star Saga DX, which is like that WayForward GBA shooter, like shmup RPG type game. The PS5 version of Starfield. Sea of Stars is hitting mobile. It's kind of just like we talked about this with Drova, which I think just came out on mobile. They're kind of interesting to get these.
That's coming later.
Oh, sorry. Oh, that's April 23. And yeah. I was thinking March 23. So getting those like just kind of more traditional RPGs on a mobile platform rather than a gacha RPG. That's always cool.
Yeah. Maybe I'll be here next week talking about Starfield. We'll see.
But yeah, who would play gacha RPGs? Am I right?
No one
normal.
Anyways, so long, stay safe, take care. We'll talk to y'all next time.